Okay, let's get this show on the road. We'll open up the Senate Interim Committee on Business and Transportation for Wednesday, December 15th. And we're meeting in subcommittee until we have one member that's in another committee that is going long. Obviously does not have a very good chairman to mention they're going that long. And then we have another member that'll be here shortly. So, but we'll start with our informational stuff. I mean, this is a very exciting year. You know, as you all know, I mean, the Oregon Ducks are going to the national championship game, so it's the year of the Ducks. So it's very appropriate that we begin the committee today with the two lame ducks, Martha and me.
Right back at you, buddy.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll open this as a lame ducks subcommittee. And we'll begin with the status of projects funded by House Bill 2001. Paul Mather from the Oregon Department of Transportation. Enter and sign in, please.
He's going to have a PowerPoint.
All right, let's get fired up here for PowerPoint. And see, you guys really like coming to the committee when we meet in subcommittee, because the fewer people are here, the fewer questions get answered. They can get through it before they show up.
With you, Mr.
Welcome.
Chairman.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Metzger, members of the committee. Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT. Today, I just want to give you our report on projects in general, but specifically on the Jobs and Transportation Act and some of the other initiatives that we have in the department. I wanted to take a little different approach today to my presentation, and as I move on the presentation, I wanted to cover some of the specific projects that we have underway this summer relative to JTA and show you a few pictures and give you some anecdotal kind of success stories that are going on in each of those projects. But before I get into that, I'll cover some of our other program areas, starting with our OTIA 3 bridge program. Our OTIA 3 bridge program is really on the final lap. We have here in a few months, we're going to celebrate the final bid opening of the bundles of bridges that we have out to bid. And so we'll be just solely in construction, through design, through planning stages, and just into construction. We have two very challenging bridges kind of at the end of our program that we're working through, the Willamette River Bridge in I-5 in Eugene and the Sandy River Bridge in I-84 near Troutdale. Very large, very complex, challenging projects, but we're continuing to move through those. The program in general stays on track, schedule-wise and budget-wise, no major concerns with the program. Or any particular projects at this point.
And if I can interrupt you just right there, because I think it's important, because we passed this legislation way back in 2003. We have since moved through this whole system. I know that because of some cost savings, we were able to do some things that we originally, you know, hadn't promised we would do, but we would try to do, and we were able to do some of that. And I think the point that you made, because I want people, you know, who watch this off and on in the next few weeks to understand, because a lot of things are difficult to project and do. But you know, the department has done a great job on OTIA 3 by delivering what we said we would deliver. You know, when you talk about all these huge cost overruns on single things, you know, that met the budget, and then sometimes we've been able to receive more than we promised for the budget. Mm-hmm. And I just think the whole department, everyone, and our partners should be congratulated for that, because I think it's important that people know when you're talking about, you know, billions of dollars, literally, over the last 7 years, and be able to deliver what we said we would deliver, and in the cost frame that we said we would deliver, is important to know. You know, there's other things that have difficulty, but you know, in state government, but that's one, and I think you should be commended for that. And I just want to make a point.
Well, appreciate those comments, but it's been truly a team effort. The contractors, AGC, consulting industry, it's all really many players around the table in Oregon coming together to make this a success story, and it's been great to be part of that as an agency as well. Moving on to Connect Oregon, the Connect Oregon 1 and 2 programs are well underway, and there's some details there in my testimony. On the Connect Oregon 3, as I was here in September, reported, our commission in August gaveled down on 41 multimodal projects totaling $97 million. Also, 57 rural airports totaling $4.4 million. During the last several months, we've been working hard to get the agreements on those projects processed, and we have the majority of those through the process, and in fact, we even have a couple projects out for construction. So that program continues to move rapidly along to get those projects and the jobs out there in each of those communities. Moving on now to the JTA projects. Again, in my testimony, you'll see the website that tracks all our projects. Again, the requirement of the legislation was that we had a website that people were able to track each of the projects that were specified in JTA, and that web address is in there, and you can track those. But I wanted to go through, again, some of the specific projects that we have under construction this summer. Starting with one in Hood River. This project is actually a combination of a couple different funding sources that we've talked about. The bridge in this picture is an OTIA 3 bridge that was funded through the OTIA 3 program to replace. But many in the community know that there's other issues at this interchange besides just the bridge from an operational standpoint, from a congestion, safety, site distance, issues that also need to be addressed. But the bridge funding was just for the bridge. With the JTA funding, we were able to combine those projects together and really solve many problems with one project. The contractor on this project is Moore Excavation. They're a smaller contractor that is, Moore Excavation. This is one of the first times they've been a prime contractor for ODOT, and they've been great to work on the project. I've got a couple pictures of their workers out there working on the project. The next project I wanted to touch on is 185th or Cornell. This is on US 26 west of Portland. It extends the three-lane section on US 26 further to the west. Again, a capacity project needed in that area to just meet the needs of congestion and mobility in that area. And that's a project that we had kind of on the books, on the shelf, waiting for funding, and the JTA came along. We were able to move rapidly along with that project. Both the previous project and this project are partway done. We've put them kind of to bed for the wintertime, and we'll be finishing them up in the spring.
Senator Starr has a question, Mr. Manning.
I didn't know if you – I wanted to wait. Have you done talking about this project?
This is a good point. Yeah, ask questions. Go ahead.
So, obviously, I'm very familiar with the project and understand it pretty well. I drive it road every day. The question I have is, you've already built – you basically got four lanes across the freeway now, based on how the project has been built, is what I can see. I'm just a little confused why we aren't driving on all three lanes. I mean, you built additional lanes, and now you're carving everybody into two lanes, creating a lot more traffic than is even normal because of the medians. I'm just confused. I mean, maybe it's because I don't have a clue about construction, but you've built two new lanes, brand new lanes, and you've carved everybody into those two lanes, and everybody's driving by all this capacity on the right-hand side that where we all used to drive. Now we have four lanes across the freeway, and we're carving everybody into two lanes, creating massive traffic jams every day.
Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, I understand the question. I don't have the specifics. We do have David Kim in the audience. If you allow me, I can ask him to come up and maybe help us answer that specific question.
Let's do it.
David is our area manager locally, and the project managers on site work for David.
Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, the project ultimately is going to be adding a third lane on the outside of the project. And so what they're having to do right now is they're in winter shutdown, but once they get started on the project again, they're going to be reconstructing the shoulders. The shoulders were not constructed to handle traffic, so they're going to have to reconstruct the shoulders. While they're reconstructing the shoulders, they're going to need that third current lane to allow construction equipment to go back and forth. And so,
are you going to tear up the lane you built in the middle?
It's a temporary lane to provide a safe place for the contractor to get in and rebuild that shoulder and the new third lane and new shoulder. It's going to be a new 12-foot lane and a new 10-foot shoulder.
Can I just – makes me really want to bite my tongue because it's really hard for the public to understand that. You need to do a better job of explaining the process to the public, because the public is looking at this, and I've heard people complain to me. You know, we've got all this capacity where we all used to drive. We're all watching it every day. It's completely vacant. Traffic backs up for miles in both directions now because you're funneling them into these lanes with the medians. There's this huge capacity sitting there not being used. And, you know, we watched with glee these new lanes get built all summer long. And everybody's, yay, we're building new lanes, way to go. And now it's just a disaster because we're funneling everybody into these little lanes. We've got this huge capacity on the side that nobody's driving on.
Can I ask a technical
question? Well, sure, let him respond and then Senator Schrader.
Chair Metzger, Senator Starr. The challenge is that the contractor is not able to complete all the work in one season. And so if we're to open up a lane today to make it three through lanes and then to come back next summer and try to close that up, it's going to create more traffic confusion amongst the traveling public.
All I can say is we've been driving on those lanes that are vacant there for the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. And within the last 3 years, there's been an overlay on all of that. It's not like it's old pavement. It's just not a very good PR play on the department for sure. And as somebody who championed that project and got it into the bill, it's hard for me to explain to my constituents when they're driving in congestion. It's actually worse today than it was before the construction started. So, at some level, you have to figure out how to communicate these messages better with the public.
I appreciate your comments, and we will make note of those and see what we can do in the future as well as on this project to correct that.
Senator Schrader.
Yeah, this is the technical question I have. When you say temporary lane, again, it's still infrastructure that you're investing in. So what's the qualitative difference between what's different with a temporary lane versus something that's kind of being built that's going to be there for years? Because when you say temporary, what does that mean? I mean, you couldn't be investing the same amount of dollars in something temporary. So qualitatively, what's the difference between a temporary versus when you're really...
Chair Metzger, Senator Schrader, when we mean temporary, they're not putting in all the aggregate base to be able to handle the loads for freight. It's temporary. Once the project's complete, they'll take that out. We're trying to minimize throwaway, but also allow safe room for the contractor to build that third lane appropriately and the shoulder. They need that extra space. And with the existing lanes in place, there's no way for the contractor to be able to construct that third lane safely.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, I see another PR problem coming up big time. Is you're going to tear out the lanes you just built, and the public is going to look. They're going to like, what in the heck? How stupid? How wasteful can we be? We build this infrastructure again. We watched it be built all summer long, and I know I was excited, and I know people that I talked to were excited about it. Finally, after all this time, we're going to get more capacity in 26. So now you're going to tell me that I'm going to have to tell them that oh, you know, all that new infrastructure we saw go in over the summertime, it's all coming out.
Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, that's correct. It's a temporary lane. From a construction staging standpoint, we have to be able to provide enough working room for the contractor to build.
I understand that it's temporary for the contractor, right. But you have the public driving on it all summer, all winter long,
yeah.
In all kinds of weather.
Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, I understand your point. I think we need to do a better job in cases like this in matching the expectations we need for contractors, temporary lanes they need, with public expectations when they drive by a job and what they see. So we'll, again, take a look at this particular project as well as our future practices to better communicate and better stage our projects to manage these issues.
I would suggest perhaps that we don't tear the lanes out but restrict them to vehicle traffic and no trucks and have additional capacity there. I will tell you, people will not be happy when they see new infrastructure getting torn out in a year. It goes to the whole government is wasteful theme that, as a legislator, we hear over and over again.
Good points. Thank you. Thank you, David.
A couple more projects just to share with you. These are in southern Oregon on Oregon 140. Oregon 140 runs from Klamath Falls through Lakeview and on into Nevada. JTA funded a series of projects in that corridor, and two of those we were able to get under construction this year. This first one is the Beatty Curves project. Here's a picture of what the curve looked like before, during construction. JAL Construction Incorporated was the contractor on the project, and they were able to get this project finished this summer. Further to the east is the Warner Curves project. Here's a picture of what that project looked like beforehand. Johnny Cat Incorporated was the contractor on the project, a local firm out of the Medford area. And here's a finished product of what that project looked like. This is a key corridor for that part of the state for freight and for the local community, and both these projects will greatly enhance the mobility on that highway.
Great.
But that includes my report.
Okay. Questions on projects 2001? Any questions on this topic?
The projects that you went over, they're the ones that are under construction, correct?
Chair Metzger, Senator Stark, yes. I believe there are other ones under construction as well. Those are the ones I just highlighted today. We have three more that are going to go to bid in the next several months as well. In general, the JTA program is kind of, relative to some of our other programs, is relatively slow starting because most of the projects require extensive planning, environmental document work, and they'll be later in the process. These are ones that we happen to have ready for a variety of reasons, able to get them out earlier.
So what you didn't provide us is any numbers. The bill specified specific dollar amounts for each of these projects.
Yes.
Were the bids below or above? Were they on target? Is there quote unquote money left on the table because the bids came under the amount that was identified in the bill?
Chair Medgar, Senator Starr, with the 140 projects I talked about, there's a series of projects in that corridor, and so the money will be used that was saved in the bidding process, and those two curve projects will be used in other projects identified in JTA in that corridor. The project in Hood River is matched with the OTEA 3 bridge project, and the bids on that project came out what we expected, but the 185th of Cornell project was significantly lower than what our bids were for lower than what we'd estimated or lower than what was in the JTA legislation.
Can I follow up?
Yeah.
So the 140. Was that project, as it was written into the bill, more flexible? That allowed so you could spend the money anywhere on 140. Is that the deal?
Senator Metzger, Senator Starr? Yes, it was the way the bill was written. It was in the corridor improvements in that corridor between Klamath Falls and on past Lakeview in the 140 corridor. So the definition that was in the legislation was much broader, for example, than the 185th or Cornell, which was very prescriptive in the limits on that project versus 140 from Klamath Falls to the Nevada border.
The I-84 Hood River interchange, the legislature nailed it right on. Is that what you're telling me?
I'd have to go back and look at the exact dollar amounts, but it was much closer. The 185th of Cornell was a significant difference.
So if you can just make a note, I'd like to know specifically where we were up, where we were down, where we were sideways, because I believe that the incoming legislature is going to have to address that legislatively, and I need to have the best information possible on all the projects, top to bottom.
Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, yes, we will do that. We have recognized that as an issue. One of the things I have to go back and check on the project in Hood River, sometimes in these projects we're able to scope the project differently as we get into the project. So if the bids come in relatively close, we're able through change orders to add additional scope to the project that we'd maybe scoped out of the project thinking it was going to be above the estimate. We were able to put back and still meet the intent of the legislation. So there's some nuances on some of those ones that come in very close. 185th Cornell, though, was significantly different.
Great. Thank you. Appreciate your information.
Yes, please.
I just have a question here as I'm looking through the quarterly project status report. And, again, the area of interest to me has always been the Highway 212 Sunrise Corridor Phase 1, and it's still listed as having an environmental impact statement process going on. Why is this taking so long? When I was wearing my other hat, as a commissioner, we kind of had EISs, DEISs, you know, kind of. So what is actually, can you give me some clarity as to what's really happening with that particular project at this point?
Chair Metzger, Senator Schrader, probably not to the detail you need. It would probably be good if I followed up with some of our regional staff to give you that specific answer afterwards, if that's acceptable to you.
I'm just curious because it, to my institutional knowledge, yeah, it's kind of been EIS to death, so I'm not sure why it seems to be stalled at this stage. And at least for our county in Clackamas, it's one of the key industrial corridors in our right. in that region. So, thank you.
Good, thank you.
Any other questions on this topic? Okay. Okay. We'll be hearing from Paul later again. But now we'll close the informational hearing on 2001, and we'll open a report from the ATV Advisory Committee relating to Senate Bill 578 with Kylene Stone and Wayne Rollins.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Metzger, members of the committee. I'm Kylene Stone, Assistant Director of Recreation Programs and Planning at the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. And I have with me Wayne Rollins. He is our grants manager, and he's here to answer the really hard questions that you might present us today. I am here today to report on our progress implementing Senate Bill 578 and present the report of the ATV Advisory Committee that was formed as a result of that bill. And I understand that Mr. Brennan had supplied you with an electronic version of the reports, and then I've got handouts that went around as well. Before I go into the report findings, I would like to take a moment to give you a little bit of background information about the ATV program, just a really short history program there, and then also make some specific acknowledgments, particularly related to the committee members. Just as a reminder for folks, in case you don't remember, the ATV grant program was transferred to the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department in the year 2000. And at that time, that was a new constituency group for the department, and it has taken us a few years to really get to know and understand that group and that form of recreation. We think we're getting better, and we probably still have a ways to go, but we are trying to reconcile some of the issues that form of recreation creates. So we have appreciated the chance to get up to speed on that. One of the things we have observed, though, over the years is there is a remarkable characteristic about the people who participate in the sport, and it really is their willingness to offer their time and their resources to make it safe and enjoyable and truly a good form of recreation for the state. And if you would, for a moment, just indulge me, if you could turn to page 23 of the report that I just handed out. I would like to just take a moment to acknowledge specifically the folks who are on our ATV Advisory Committee and also just give you a little bit of background about who they are so that you can understand who I'm presenting this report on behalf of today. Representing Class 1 ATVs, and those are the quads, that is a fellow named Wade Bryant, and he comes to us from Bend. Representing Class 2, which are the Jeeps and Dune Buggies, is Ms. Pat Harris, and she is the chair of our ATV Advisory Committee. She lives in Keno, Oregon, which is near Klamath Falls, and she is unable to join us today. She had hoped to, but she actually has an injury not related to ATV recreation and is unable to be here, and she sends her regrets. Stephen Doan is our representative for Class 3, and that is motorcycle dirt bike recreation. Tim Custer from Salem is our all-terrain vehicle user at large. He actually recreates in a variety of forms of machines, and he's the vice chair of our committee, and he also was unable to attend because he had a work conflict, so he apologizes as well. Jimmy Smith is an all-terrain vehicle dealer. And then we have several folks who represent agencies and land managers, including Troy Costales from the Department of Transportation, Nathan Siebel from the Department of State Forestry, Lisa Millay from the Department of Human Services, Wendy Zistiak from the U.S. Forest Service, Rod Roberts, who is a Coos County Sheriff deputy and represents law enforcement, and then our own staff person, John Lane, who represents safety, ATV safety. So I appreciate that time to just help you understand who those folks are. They each of them have dedicated innumerable hours to this cause, and we appreciate it. And now I'd like to give you the Senate Bill 578 report. So Senate Bill 578 created the ATV Advisory Committee and charged them to do the following tasks: review accidents and fatalities, recommended changes to the statutory vehicle classifications, review safety features of off-highway vehicles, recommend safety requirements to protect children, and report back to this committee. And so I'd like to just go through those categories really quickly, and these are all written in the report, but this is the summary. First of all, related to accidents and fatalities, Senate Bill 101, which was adopted in the 2009 legislative session and co-sponsored, I believe, by Senator Metzger and Senator Devlin, is phasing in now. And that one of the key features of that bill was that we provide mandatory safety education to all riders of ATVs, and that phased in starting with children who became who were required on January 1st, 2009 to be trained, and eventually by the year 2014, all people who ride on public lands will have to have gone through an online training course. As of today, 111,500 people have completed the online training.
How many?
111,000.
Well, that's a lot.
That's a lot of people. We also are in the process of implementing a hands-on training requirement for children in particular. So besides the online training component, we would also like to have children have a hands-on component to ensure that they fit safely on the vehicles that they ride. And that will be implemented in the year 2012. And we are well on our way to meeting that requirement. We also, OPRD, our department, is working with first responders, including sheriffs and law enforcement and hospitals, to improve accident reporting, both on the site of accidents and in the hospital, so that we have a better sense of what safety issues might be happening out there when people are acting in ATV recreation. And then as a result of that improved reporting system, we have a contract with the Department of Human Services to study the results of that and make any adjustments to our safety training curriculum so that we make sure that we are providing the utmost opportunity for safe recreation. Because we're just now in the phases of implementing Senate Bill 101, we don't yet have data, conclusive data. We do have some anecdotal data. The most striking piece of data that we have is that since the online training requirement began in 2009, we've had no child fatalities in public riding areas. So that appears to be headed us in the right direction. Related to their requirement to look at vehicle classifications, this is probably the most substantial part of the work that they've done. Current law provides three vehicle classifications. As I mentioned, we have quads, four-wheel drives, and dirt bikes. Those are class 1, 2, and 3. A new type of vehicle, the side-by-side, has emerged and is not covered in those classes. These side-by-sides differ from quads in a couple of significant ways. A quad has saddle seats. A side-by-side either has bench seats or bucket seats that require seat belts. A quad steers with handlebars, and the side-by-side steer with steering wheels. So there's different requirements and safety elements implicit in those differences. Also, the side-by-sides are lighter and not as wide as, say, Jeeps and the four-wheel drive vehicles that people would drive on the street. The ATV Advisory Committee is recommending statutory changes, and our commission actually concurs with that recommendation. And we've been working through Mr. Brennan with the House Transportation Committee to help us create some legislation for the upcoming session, and that is legislative concept 1511, and they actually adopted that yesterday. The safety requirements to protect children, one other piece of the significant piece of the report, again related to the class 4 vehicles. The ATV Advisory Committee is recommending that we make it a requirement that that class 4 vehicles are administered according to manufacturer's directions. And most manufacturers require a driver's license in order to operate a side-by-side, but there is a one manufacturer right now, and we would anticipate more that have small enough models that children to the age of, at a minimum age, at a maximum sorry, at a minimum age of 12 could potentially ride. So we see that if that is the case and those are out there, we could potentially have some child operators, so we would be developing rider fit guidelines and a safety curriculum specifically to side-by-sides for those smaller vehicles. The ATV Advisory Committee will be working with us to establish administrative rules to administer that piece of the program in the coming years. And then finally, additional analysis will be ongoing to ensure that children are protected while riding or as passengers on any and all of these pieces of equipment. We also have a couple of miscellaneous housekeeping issues related to our committee membership and some grammatical issues from Senate Bill 101 that need to be fixed. And those are also incorporated into that recommended statutory change. And that really is a summary of the report of Senate Bill 578, and I can answer any questions that you might have.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Schreyer.
Yeah, just one question, kind of an institutional memory. Why was this removed and moved to parks? I know there's a recreation component, but I'm just curious as to genesis of that was.
Chair Metzger, Senator Schrader, I actually don't know the answer to that. It actually occurred before my time, and I don't know if we have anybody in our department who has that institutional memory. Do you?
I don't.
That's great. It's quite funny, actually. No one in our department has any institutional memory, but
just
I know that's not what I meant, but it just caught me kind of funny, you know.
No, but I would, and I do understand. I didn't mean to put you on the spot, quite frankly. I was just curious because it is kind of a hybrid, so it might be nice at some point in my future. This might just be a piece of information I just would like to know about.
I apologize.
Well, I appreciate your work on this. I remember, actually it was 07, because Senate Bill 101 was a climate bill. Maybe there's a relationship from last session, but I remember the very avid discussion of this back in the 07 session, and true to the work that you've been doing that you said was most extensive was on defining the different categories, because that was the whole issue, was when you talked about all the safety issues and child things, et cetera, and then trying to define that to a specific group of vehicles that no longer fit our definitions, that the arguments were valid because our the way we define things, that things had been created that just didn't fit the old days. And so I'm hopeful that the next session will, as they work through your work product, we'll get that done so that when we look at future rules or regulations, we know that the vehicles that are applied to would be the ones and not the ones that that you might actually be doing more harm than good at. And because I remember all those discussions. And so I appreciate your work on this, because it is complex. Mm-hmm. And trying to write something that when a new vehicle hits the market 5 years from now, that somehow you'll be able to fit it into a classification without having to come up with a new one all over again.
Right.
So I appreciate that. Any other questions for this panel? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome, Senator Verger. I know you've been a busy person today.
Thank you.
And I know you have to testify later also. So, okay, we'll close that public hearing and open a public hearing on the report from Lane County on the Area Commission on Transportation Creation. Alex, I would not be a transportation year without something regarding Lane County. So we appreciate this is your opportunity.
Thank you, Chair Metzger, members of the committee. I'm Alex Kyler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. And I am here to report back to you on Senate Bill 944. The bill did require that Lane County create an area commission on transportation. We were one of the only two areas in the state that do not have an act, and that just leaves the metro area now without an area commission on transportation. The bill did require that we report to the legislature at the end of October. And I did send that a report to Administrator Brennan at that point in time. I believe you've gotten one electronically, if not a hard copy. At the time, we had not received a approval of what's called our charter from the Oregon Transportation Commission, and we went to the OTC on November 9th. They did approve the charter that we presented at that time, and thus one of the documents you've received is an addendum to that legislatively required report that indicates what happened at OTC on November 9th. So what I thought I would do is very briefly, I'm going to just go over what an Area Commission on Transportation is, why there was a need for it in Lane County, some of the work we did to modify the bill, how we implemented it, and now that it's formed, what it will do in Lane County, and I'll do that very quickly. So an Area Commission on Transportation is a construct of the Oregon Transportation Commission. Acts ensure that regions have widespread public involvement in prioritizing their transportation infrastructure needs. It's their advisory to the OTC, and it's an important function in that it gets as many people, as many stakeholders together as possible, such that the OTC can make good decisions as it distributes money that comes either out of federal gas tax or state gas tax. And as they look to distribute that money locally, with the acts, they're ensured that everybody has had a voice at the table and there's an agreed upon local procedure about how to prioritize that spending. The bill itself was sponsored by Representative Paul Holvey and Senator Floyd Brzezinski. It was deemed to be necessary. In fact, they'd tried in 2007 to pass the bill. It did ultimately pass in the 2009 session. It was deemed to be necessary in that the thought, at any rate, was that because Lane County was making those prioritizations through the Board of County Commissioners, there were some concern from the smaller cities that their voices were not heard at the board in order to get some of their projects, their high priority projects, at least into the list for consideration. And specifically, we've got a particularly bad stretch of highway between Eugene and Veneta that goes across Fernandez Reservoir. And the city of Veneta especially was concerned that that project was not really getting any federal dollars allocated towards it. So county initially opposed the bill. You probably recall we had testimony in front of your committee where a couple commissioners came up and were not happy with it. You'll probably recognize the name of Commissioner Bill Dwyer, former state senator, never liked the idea of an Area Commission on Transportation. He felt like it was the elected official's duty to make those priorities on behalf of the citizens and has never really appreciated the construct there of an appointed board that he would then have to sort of make a recommendation to. There was also just a sort of the overarching concern about local control. We were able to modify the bill a bit in that we suggested, and it did make it into language on the House side, that the OTC would not be able to reject the charter that we put forward based on the membership or the composition of the membership of the Area Commission on Transportation. That turned out to be a very important language as we negotiated towards the end on this Area Commission on Transportation. And as you suggested, things are a bit different in Lane County, and we were particularly concerned that we might propose something that was a little bit outside the box for OTC, and so we wanted to have that as a bit of an insurance policy such that OTC would not reject on the first go-round. In fact, we took a version up to the OTC in September, and there was a lot of debate about what was being presented by Lane County at the time. There wasn't a whole lot of local support for what was being proposed, and the OTC didn't say yay or nay. They just simply said, please go back and work on this some more. They did a terrific job of reminding the various the cities and the counties that had sort of opposite positions about the purpose of an act, and especially the need to have everybody at the table and the local collaboration that was necessary. And that really set the stage for a fairly lengthy meeting in October where we were able to sort of hammer out the details on that. So we did go to work on implementing the bill just after the legislature closed. The first thing that the county did was we hired a consultant to help us work through that process. The consultant suggested to form a forum on an area commission on transportation, and he brought an enormous number of people together to reach consensus on what this charter would look like. There were other acts that were brought in from around the state to make recommendations and tell the forum what worked and what did not work, and their experience with the act. And they all worked towards consensus and, in fact, achieved consensus after about four meetings. The problem was is that the county had one representative on that forum who had been pretty active with it, and when he brought the issue back to the full board, the full board was not in particular agreement with what this forum had suggested. So there were a number of meetings where those issues were sort of hammered out. As I said, we did involve the OTC, went to the OTC in September, with sort of these competing versions of a charter. They said, please go away, but come back in November. And indeed we did. They voted 4-0 at the time to accept our charter. And what had really changed over that period was that the Board of Commissioners was comfortable with increasing the number of citizen volunteers who would be a part of the Area Commission on Transportation. And they were also satisfied with the city's requirement that the act itself appoint those citizen members. That had been a sticking point, that the board had felt that they should appoint the citizen members. So that all got resolved, and the OTC was happy with it. So where we are right now is that the Oregon Department of Transportation is now contracting with the Lane Council of Governments in order to staff this thing moving forward and have it implemented. The Roads Advisory Committee in Lane County appointed their person for our act just a few days ago. We are working on an appointment for a citizen volunteer for one corridor that has no incorporated cities on it. It's the Highway 126 East corridor, and so there will be a representative of that corridor on the act. That person is the deadline, at any rate, for applications is on the 22nd of this month. On January 12th, the Board of County Commissioners will appoint their person who will be on the act, and the cities are being encouraged as well to appoint their representatives. There's 12 cities in Lane County. They all get a seat at the table. So they're being encouraged to appoint their people. And then that group will convene and appoint the citizen members after that. So really by that'll happen February through April. Really by about May, we should be up and running with the Lane County Act. And instead of the five Board of County Commissioners making recommendations to the OTC, we will have 29 to 31 people on the Area Commission on Transportation. And it should give very balanced view of how to allocate transportation dollars, at least from our perspective in Lane County, and make those recommendations to the OTC.
Thank you, Mr. Kyler. Any questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Berger.
Yes. Well, I don't know about 25 or 30 people. that's a big group to come to some pretty good decisions. One of the things that you said that caught my attention is that Lane County is different. You know, we all have that feeling in our districts. And as a cheerleader for the acts, I want to tell you that's going to be one of the things that they will enjoy the most. That's the purpose of the acts, is that you're making decisions in this small area what your people think is the best. And what I have found at working with the ACT in my area is that that's exactly what it does. The people know the area. Mm-hmm. They want to feel like they have a say in what they're doing. And I think that even your naysayers that have gone through all of this kind of anxiety, I believe we'll look back on these decisions as being extremely good ones.
Thank you, Senator Metzger, Senator Verger. In fact, through this activity, these four meetings where the stakeholders came together to suggest a charter, it's had some really pretty positive spillover effects in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
The cities who had worked together but not quite in that manner really found common cause through that process, and they mentioned on a number of occasions that it was a pretty positive experience for them, and hopefully there is some
Absolutely.
Of that spillover. So,
yeah.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, we'll close that informational hearing. Open a congestion pricing pilot program report. Dave Williams.
Good afternoon, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Dave Williams. I'm filling in for Jason Tell, who's the ODOT Region 1 manager. He's under the weather. And so what I'm here to do is to give you an update on the congestion pricing pilot program that was mandated in the Jobs and Transportation Act. It worked yesterday.
You're up. It's coming.
By way of background, this is a brief description of what the provision of the bill does. The committee, the partner jurisdictions that are mentioned in the top bullet are a metro, the city of Portland, Clackamas, Washington, and Multnomah counties. The annual report mentioned at the bottom is due every December and was submitted in November. What I'm going to focus on are the analytical findings to date for two pilot proposals. However, we should explain first how we got to these two proposals. After passage of the Act, ODOT formed a congestion pricing advisory committee made up of elected officials of those named jurisdictions. We then formed a technical advisory committee which oversaw all the technical analysis I'm going to report on today. We then solicited pilot proposals from those jurisdictions to be analyzed by the TACs. I think we started with 10 or 11 proposals. We screened them down by requiring, A, that each proposal have a local sponsor, that those proposals are supported by other affected jurisdictions, that they can be implemented by September 2012, which was a provision of the statute, and that they had a high likelihood of success. Three pilots were selected for consideration, two road pricing proposals, which I'm going to describe today, and a parking management proposal from the City of Portland that's still being developed. These are the analytical components of the work that we're doing on the pilot projects. The first one I want to talk about is Cornelius Pass Road, which is, if you're familiar with it, this is a rural county road that connects Route 30 with Washington County running over the ridge from the Columbia River. And the proposal is to have a point toll collection, so the toll will only be collected in one location, which would be right near the intersection with Route 30. All of the collection and enforcement for the tolls would be done electronically, so that enforcement, if somebody drove through, they didn't have a transponder, we'd take a photograph of their license plate and use that as the means of levying a fine. The tolls would vary by time of day, which is really the definition of congestion pricing. So the peak period toll would be higher than the off-peak. Here's the operational data for Cornelius Pass Road. It's a two-lane rural highway. Traffic volumes over the period studied range from 10,000 to 16,000 vehicles per day, and we have a fairly high percentage of trucks at 15%. The reason for this is primarily that this is a hazardous material route. A number of hazardous materials are not allowed through the Vista Ridge Tunnel on 26, and so they access Washington County by Cornelius Pass Road. The analysis, and I should stop here, the analysis that you're going to see on the traffic behavior is performed by the Metro Transportation Demand Model, which now can factor in not only travel time differences, but cost differences to the use of the road. The project had these objectives. One is that Multnomah County has had a long concern with some safety problems up on Cornelius Pass Road, so the idea was to see if we could use the toll revenues to fund safety improvements along the corridor, and then additionally increase travel reliability on the road. Now, there are some issues that were pretty apparent were going to arise. One is the diversion of traffic around the tolls. If you're familiar with Cornelius Pass Road, there aren't a lot of parallel high-quality facilities to the road. So the question is, would some of the traffic divert to these lower-order facilities? And then second, if the proposal moves forward, we're probably going to have to consider exemptions for people that live on the road itself, because they would be getting tolled just coming and going. People react to price. Here is what you can see from this, is how the motorists react to putting on the tolls. That even at the smallest toll amount, we see at least a 50% reduction in auto use on the facility. The trucks are not tolled, so they're not affected or represented on this graph. By the time you get up to a $4 per use toll, the traffic has dropped off rather considerably. Where do they go?
Just for a moment, Senator Spire.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Chairman Mesker, Senator Spire. Just a quick question. There's no improvements to the roadways contemplated as part of this pilot?
Yes, there is. The idea would be to take any net revenue above cost and apply it to a series of safety projects on the road. We currently have a study undergoing by ODOT to identify which of those projects should be in scoping out the dollar amounts, what they would cost. So the idea would be, yes, to make improvements to Cornelius Pass Road with the excess revenues.
So you're gonna widen and straighten the road so it's more user-friendly. You're going to create a facility that actually can effectively move traffic and freight between Highway 30 and Highway 26, or are you just going to put up a guardrail here and a guardrail there?
I think we're going to do more than a guardrail here, but I don't have the projects yet. That study is still going on. The idea was to figure out where we have the greatest safety problems and make improvements there.
Go ahead.
Where does the traffic go that avoid the tolls? Well, here you see the two primary parallel facilities, Rocky Point Road and the Logie Trail Road. And you can see the amount, given as you escalate the toll, the amount of cars that divert to those facilities. Now, what's important when you get to this high 4,000 diversion to Logie Trail is, this isn't totally rocket science, but the carrying capacity of a rural road like that is in the 3,000 to 5,000 range. So you're actually beginning to approach probably the capacity of the parallel road. And so the question would be is whether or not you're introducing safety problems on these small roads. Here is a picture of Logie Trail Road. It's narrow. It's paved, but it's got ditches on both sides. It's not very wide. It's windy, and it has very limited passing. So the question will be, which we have not gone forth and analyzed yet, is if you divert a lot of cars to this road, are you, in essence, creating a traffic problem somewhere else when you're trying to solve one on Cornelius Pass at the same time? How much money do you generate? Well, here you can see that annually, the medium toll generates the most revenue. Now, this is gross, not net. I'll come back and show what the net is. But the point here is that there's an optimal. And after that, you divert so many cars don't drive that the revenue collection goes down. And so the optimal in this case was a $2 toll. Now, when you look at this on a net basis, you have to remember that you have to install at the front end the toll collection equipment that you're going to use to collect the tolls and to photograph the scoff laws, and each transaction will have a cost to it as well. So what we found here is that, in essence, it takes 5 years worth of traffic to pay off the initial capital cost of putting the toll collection equipment in place. But you do generate positive revenue at the end, and the amount that you would generate is $6.3 million, recognizing there's going to be somewhat of an error factor around those numbers. They're not hard and fast, but it looks like you'll generate in the neighborhood of $6 million.
Senator Starr has another question.
I'm sorry.
So did you engage any private sector companies to operate and manage the project, put in the toll, manage the toll, monitor the road, or is this just assuming the department's going to do this all?
Senator Metzger, Senator Starr, no, we have not contacted anyone yet, fearing that's a little premature. We'll see whether we're going to go forward. But what we did do was contract a consulting firm that does this stuff to give us the estimates of what it would take to operate it. And they were also the ones that reviewed the numbers.
Can I ask another question, Mr.
Chair? Yeah, sure.
Whose idea was it to include this as a congestion pricing in this pilot?
Oh, Multnomah County. Multnomah County and then Washington County co-sponsored it with them.
And in that contemplation of this project, was there no conversation about improving the facility as part of a congestion pricing pilot? I mean, if you're going to toll a facility, it seems to me that in order to make it attractive for the public to use, you'd want to marry that tolling with additional lanes, passing lanes, straightening the road. The road is immensely dangerous, and it's heavily used. And if I were given the choice, your numbers to me are just, no offense, but they're no brainers. I mean, if I'm going to have to pay $2 to drive on Cornelius Pass Road, and I can go on Logie Trail Road and not pay any toll and get to the same place, they're both equally. Logie Trail is a little more windy, a little narrower, it's more scenic.
Okay.
I've seen more elk on Logie Trail than I have on Cornelius Pass. It's a no-brainer that the people would say, "Well, I can drive on Logie Trail or Rocky Point." Rocky Point would. It's a little more. I mean, if you're coming from Scappoose or up that way, perhaps Rocky Point makes more sense.
Well, Senator Mester, Senator Starr, the answer is yes, but we had a sequencing problem, and that Multnomah County.
I would suggest then that it doesn't make any sense to do this study if you're not going to marry it with a proposal that you're going to talk to the people. Well, if you're going to toll or poll people, you have to tell them we're going to build this new road. And we're going to improve this facility. It's going to be fantastic. Instead of taking, however long it takes now to wind up and down that road behind a truck that's going 10 miles an hour, you're going to have passing lanes and you're going to have, shoulders and, there's going to be ability to have turnouts and whatnot. It seems to me that would have to be married with a proposal if you're going to toll that particular stretch of road.
Well,
am I just completely missing?
No, you're not, and I agree with you. And there's still time for to do that marriage.
What
the sequencing problem we had was we did not have at the outset a list of projects that would be the ones to put in place with the money. We had another provision of the bill which set forth the department to go out and develop that list of projects. That work's going on right now. There is still time because we have not gone out to the public with this. So there is still time if Multnomah County wants to go ahead to take the list of projects that we're developing to improve the road and make the marriage that you're suggesting. That's still possible. But you're absolutely right. Otherwise, you're just charging somebody to drive. I mean, we understand. It's just that the timing of it, if Multnomah County would add a list of projects in their pocket at the outset, we would have made the marriage earlier.
Yeah, Mr. Williams, I'm not going to be hard on you at all because I know you're pinch hitting for Jason, but and he haven't really appeared before this committee, but this committee is very, very invested in Cornelius Pass Road, and we've spent a lot of time on it. It's in JTA. We've asked for innovative proposals as opposed to the department scoping something. You know, have people tell us what they could do to really make this thing, safe and more convenient for the motoring public who are using it sometimes because they have to, like if you're a trucker, to escape the two lanes on Sunset Highway. Whatever, and it is very dangerous. We all know about the tragedies there. We've had them before our committee, and I was surprised too when I saw this even as a proposal. It's like, well, you kind of like cringe, at least I do, to think that when I go down Cornelius Pass, I wish I didn't have to, much less gee, charge me to take my life in my own hands to do that. So one of the things I think would be really, really important in terms of the marriage that you mentioned is that this would at least be an opportunity to talk about more extensively to actually look at a scope of proposals for doing major reconstruction and re-engineering of Cornelius Pass. Then this would seem to make sense because it's like, wow, I'd be willing to do that if you did this, but otherwise it's like charging me to take my life in my own hands. I mean, it doesn't make sense, and I can see why it wouldn't pencil out because it's not a desirable alternative. So, but anyway, our committee is very invested in that, so that's why you hear the comments you do. Senator Schrader.
Yeah, I'd just like to make a quick comment because you mentioned Multnomah County not queuing up the projects. At least that's what I thought I heard, and maybe I should point this out, that both Washington and Clackamas County have transportation components to their county functions. And if I remember correctly, Multnomah doesn't have that same level of capacity as the other two counties. So what you might be functionality, looking at this functionally, part of the difficulty may be is the capacity of the county to maybe queue up a project or to get that information to you. Who do you work with at Multnomah? Who is really taking the lead with this? Because that worries me a little bit.
Don't let me worry you too much. I mean, I may be misstating this, but Multnomah County, they do. They have a planning staff, and they have been concerned about the safety on Cornelius Pass Road. They commissioned a safety audit by the Federal Highway Administration to address the question. But what they haven't done, because I'm sure they were operating within their own budget constraints, and they didn't have endless money to do everything that Senator Starr suggests is probably needed up there, which is why there was a provision put in the JTA to have ODOT go out and develop what is the right set of improvements. We just have a little bit of a timing gap here between moving forward on this provision of the bill and linking it to the other one. But I'll still maintain I think it's still possible to accomplish it. We'll see if Multnomah County agrees. But the idea is to do exactly what these gentlemen are saying, mm-hmm. is to link the two. Okay? So here's the what we thought were the initial assessment of the objectives. The goal was to generate revenue to make safety improvements on the road, and you can generate $5 to $6 million over the 25 years toward that. Now, in terms of improving travel reliability on the system, this proposal, without some improvements on Cornelius Pass, would not do that. And why? Is because the diversion of the traffic around the tolls are forcing cars onto slower and longer routes. So that vehicle miles traveled and vehicle hours traveled would increase under the tolling proposal, not decrease. More safety funding, yes. But you might have the problem of having to address the safety problems on Logie Trail or the other roads where you're making them less safe because you're putting more cars on them. So how that would all net out is yet to be determined. We then went and did some attitudinal research to find out what the public thinks about a proposal like this and traffic problems in general. And this is sort of a general question that the pollsters ask because it changes sometimes over time. And what it is, I should back up and say that the poll is 300, but we focus the poll on the most likely users of the facility. So this is not a poll of the entire metro region. We took photographs of license plates, matched them up with, you know, area codes, and we just put the polls there. The poll does include Washington across it in the
Washington State.
Yes, because we found that about I'm groping for the number now, but like 10 or 15% some days are actually people coming over from Washington State using Cornelius Pass Road. And the point here, I guess, is that you see there's a wide range of issues of what people think are the important things we ought to be doing to improve the transportation system, not one or two overwhelming things we ought to be doing. So there's really quite a diversion. We also asked people whether they thought Cornelius Pass Road was safe. And here we're getting somewhat of a diversion between those of us in the business that actually study the accidents and have looked what's going on up there and general attitudes, where you'll see that 57% of those polled thought Cornelius Pass Road was relatively safe. We also asked people.
I would have loved to have seen that. Is this Cornelius Pass from the top of the hill down, or the entire stretch between Highway 26 and Highway 30?
Senator Starr, we specified that it was not the portion that stretches south into Washington County. So it would be 26 north.
So it's the Multnomah County portion of.
And a little bit in Washington County, but not the portion south of 26.
Well, I would suggest that the portion, say, south of West Union Road has been improved. And
Could be. But the idea was is that we were going to improve the connection because of the hazmat route, so we limited ourselves to 26.
Of course.
So then we asked what people thought about paying the tolls. And we had two amounts that we polled, and you can see the results here that it's not overly popular by the majority of the people. And this is not, I should say something here, because this phone survey was hitting people cold turkey, right? Nobody thought about this until they picked up the telephone and talked to the pollsters. And so these numbers, I believe, can move around, and that what we're seeing in part is the fact that we have very little history of tolling in this state. So our negatives will almost always start higher than they will in other places. So, but it is important to know where you're starting if you're going to try to sell out an idea, and so that's why we did the polls the way we did.
Well, I mean, to that point, I mean, you're right. Anything you see on this is likely to have, you know, a high negative because the base assumption of everyone is I'm paying for something that I think I've paid for, you know, so unless there's a discussion about that, and going to Senator Starr's point, I'm actually surprised that 27% even would say they would support a toll, because when there haven't been, all, you know, when they're knowing how dangerous Cornelius Pass is, it's not like if we do so-and-so, would you support it? It's basically tolling what they currently have. I'm actually surprised that even 27% would say it at that point, that they'd be willing to pay for the existing structure.
Well, here's why. For the people that said they did support that number, the green bar.
Oh, so you did ask
the green? Yeah, we followed up with them and said why, and what you see.
Oh, this is post that poll, post those numbers.
No,
you said you followed
the same
up.
People.
You followed up.
We follow up question to those that said yes, we would support it.
Okay.
And why are the reasons that are basically the reasons why the proposal has been put forward, is to maintain and improve the road, increase safety. And the other one that we didn't probably just simply foresee is that some people like it because it is a user fee concept. Mm-hmm. Those that use the road pay for the toll, and since they're the beneficiaries. Okay. We also then turned and asked those that voted why they did not like it, what reasons they gave for not liking it. And I hear that some of the numbers are things we didn't fully expect. One was the amount of skepticism, that's the top bullet, that it, this will do some good. People were frankly pretty skeptical that it would do any, would pay any good. The second bullet was the one you were just mentioning, Senator Metzger, that it's I'm paying twice for something that I've already paid for. And then in this day and age, the typical government waste numbers. But the fourth one was one that you wouldn't normally see in better times, is that people, a number of people said, look, it's a recession. You shouldn't be charging us more for much of anything. The second road project was Highway 217, and it's ramp tolling. It's taking selected ramps and putting tolls on it. Now, you need a little history of 217 when it was long and sorted, right? But it was originally planned to be an expressway back in the 50s and 60s. When it finally started getting built, however, it was built with at-grade intersections, and then through time, those intersections got upgraded to full freeway ramps. At the time, and we've looked at some of the work, but because we had to get FHWA approval for this, the spacing standards on the streets were much tighter than they are today. And so the result is that 217 has a number of ramps that by today's standards are too close, which creates weaving problems, which causes some of the congestion you see out there, and also safety problems because we get more accidents on weaves. So the idea here was if we could toll selected ramps, could we solve that weaving problem, some of the congestion on the roadway, and the safety problem caused by the weaves. Again, the tolls and there are the roads are up there, and it's all electronic, and it would vary, again, by time of day. The objectives would we get better safety on 217, greater reliability in the performance of the highway, and also is that we could take some of the trips that some people are hopping on 217 and hopping right off immediately, and in the logic of transportation planning, those trips are better on local streets rather than on the freeways, saving the freeways for longer trips. And again, here's the benefits and issues. Again, the issue is diversion around the tolled ramps. Again, what we saw, like we saw on Cornelius Pass, is people react to price. And at the high toll levels, which I'll show you in a second, the ramp volumes for autos drops rather significantly. And there is then, by extension, diversion to the parallel routes through the corridor, the heaviest on Walker Road and 99W. Now, because you're reducing the number of cars entering and leaving on 217, you also reduce the mainline volumes on 217. And at the high level, we got as much as a 10% drop in the peak direction.
Translated means no congestion.
No, it doesn't translate that well, unfortunately. The volumes go down, but you still have congestion because you're doing it over a 25-year period. Population is going up. More cars are going onto the road. So some of the benefits that you see early on, in essence, get overwhelmed in the late years by the overall growth in traffic volumes.
This is so you're looking at 25 years in the future?
Yes.
So what happens in the first year?
First year, if at the high toll, you get significant reductions and this is all our jargon now, on the ramp merging levels of service. You do get that improvement in because less cars are coming on, so there's less weaving, less accidents.
Do you have higher speeds on the freeway?
You do, yes. There is some slight increase in both reliability and throughput. But at the end of the 25 years, that disappears.
Do you assume the tolls are going to increase at the rate of inflation?
No, we did not.
Why not?
only because I think the answer is that we were granted one or two model runs by Metro, and so we could only put so many variations
in the
game.
Wouldn't it reason that if people respond to price today, that 25 years from now, $2 toll, if that's your high, that $2 25 years from now isn't enough of a financial incentive for them to modify their behavior 25 years from now?
It could. I think the more relevant question probably is whether we should consider more ramps.
Tolling more ramps?
Yes.
Or closing ramps?
Well, we initially looked at closing, and that didn't go very far, as I think you probably know. But we started, this was not our proposal, this was the proposal by Washington County, and so we took the ramps that they were interested in testing with the analysis. It's not to say that you couldn't go back and think about this in a different way. We are under the three-year time limit, and we only had so many model runs, so this is the best we could get to.
And just one other follow-up. Mm-hmm. If I read this, that your high toll is $2?
Yes.
Was there any, what was the rationale for picking that as the high toll? Because that doesn't seem like it's very much to me. Was there any study across the country what tolls are? What is this, a 7-mile facility, something like that?
What we did was, in the Metro model, there is an essence, because they make an equation between travel time changes and cost. The model tells you what a minute saving should be worth. Okay, so that's where we started. We took that value of time from the model, and we started there. And then we basically said, well, if that's what the model's telling us, why don't we take something a little smaller? Why don't we take something a little bigger and see how the motorists react to those changes? That's basically what we did.
So there wasn't a look about what average toll prices are per mile across the country. You didn't look at successful tollways.
We had our tolling consultant. Pricing. We had a consultant who actually was playing in this game and figuring out what the dollar amounts are. It's less than averages. It's that the public sort of reacts negatively among flat amounts. That they react differently at $2 than $2.15. And so most of the tolls you see on toll bridges and stuff end up settling down on something that the public reacts to as being reasonable. That, in other words, you get to the right answer of the amount you can get away with by both doing the analysis of what the travel time savings are worth, and then you back that up with how the public reacts to the amounts that you're proposing. And you dance your way, basically, to what is the amount that you end up with. I don't know how else to describe it.
Okay.
But there you can see how the traffic volumes drop off as the tolls go up. So what happens? Well, this is about how does the corridor now perform? Well, it improves. I mean, because about a quarter of the vehicles are diverting to the local streets under the high tolls. The initial model runs, which let me tell you, we're a little skeptical about, because the model, it tends to be more accurate on the freeways than it is on local streets. And that's because we have so many counting things on the freeway system that we can calibrate the model more accurately. But the model shows that the local streets can handle the diversion. And why I'm nervous about this is this sort of was contradicted by some of the things from the local government people that are responsible for those streets, and we held some focus groups, and some of the focus group answers sort of suggested the congestion on the local streets was higher than this answer is. So we'll probably have to go back and do a little bit more work if this proposal moves forward to make sure we're comfortable about this. Now, what happens is, by tolling the cars off the ramps, trucks backfill a lot of that space, and part of that is because there's less cars, but part of it is also that the ramp meters are turned off. We're using the toll now in lieu of a ramp meter. So the trucks now find travel time savings to go to those ramps that are now being tolled. They're not paying, and they're not being stopped by the meter. So when you look at the overall performance of the system, we're getting an improvement in vehicle hours of travel. It's going down. Then we're getting an improvement in vehicle miles traveled. it's going down, and then we will get a corresponding improvement in air quality as a result of those two. The thing where you see the biggest change is trucks, because trucks are actually the beneficiary of this, basically on the local system, more than on 217. They get to run to the more efficient routes that they're now avoiding because of the ramp meters. Here's the money question. Again, you reach an optimal. In this case, the optimal is the high toll. And the reason, because we had limited our slides, is that at the low toll levels, the cost, well, first you have to remember that the capital cost of 217 is going to be 6 to 10 times higher than Cornelius Pass Road, because you have more of the Gandys out there. You only had one on Cornelius Pass Road. Here you're going to have one at each of the tolled ramps. So the capital cost goes up proportionally. At the low level of toll, 25%, 25 cents, the collection cost, basically, when you add that in with the capital cost, it consumes all your revenue. So the only one of these scenarios that generated positive revenue at the end of the 25 years was the high toll, and it generated $2.8 million. So here is our initial assessment of the objectives. One is we are going to increase safety, improve safety in the corridor because of that merge improvement at those ramps. We are system-wide improving the performance of the system, and that's shown by the reductions in the VMTs and the VHTs. We are successfully reducing taking local trips off the inappropriate local trips off the freeway. And while we have diversions, it appears initially that the local system can handle it. What do people think about the tolls? Well, here are the answers to that. You can see that this proposal is supported by more people initially than the Cornelius Pass one. But the initial starting point is still below 50% in support. Why do the supporters support the idea? Well, this we see a much higher number here on ramp meters that they like the user pay concept, that only the beneficiary has to pay. They like the notion that some of the money is going to be used to improve the roadways, and they want traffic congestion reduced. The opposition is pretty much the same as we saw in Cornelius Pass. A lot of skepticism that it won't work. Bad timing because of the recession, the double payment of taxes that we saw earlier, and government waste.
And Mr. Williams, did you use the same approach to this road that you did Cornelius Pass, that is, identify people who are using 217 or using those off-ramps as the subjects of your survey?
Senator Metzger, what we did was we have a blind random sample of 300 focused on the 217 area. Because the population is so much greater in Washington County than it is out by Cornelius Pass, we were concerned of the issue I think you're getting to, is what are our likelihood that some of our poll responses would actually be people that use those ramps. Fearing that, we also held focus groups on 217, and we did three focus groups. One of people that identified themselves as infrequent users of those named ramps, two, those that identified themselves as frequent users of those ramps, and then businesses that are located off of those ramps. If you go out there is actually a fair amount of business located right off the ramps, and they would have an interest in whether or not their accessibility, if they're a retailer, is improved or worsened. So we backed up the poll in Washington County with focus groups. And what you're seeing now, you get a little bit different spin through the focus groups. The supporters and they're not everybody supported. I mean, at the end of the focus groups, you still have people that don't like the idea, let me be frank. But the things they liked was a lot of the people in the focus groups were people that are actually driving or are trying to avoid 217 now. So the fact that you might make improvements to 217, you might take the money and make improvements on those roads they're currently using, which is the idea. We wouldn't take the money and put it on 217. We'd improve the parallel facilities for the people priced off. They like those ideas because that's what they're using now. And they also showed a lot more interest in the environment than we saw from the polls. Those that oppose, again, we saw the same skepticism on effectiveness, the cost of paying the tolls. For some reason, some people couldn't understand that we're doing this electronically. They, you know, their experience is driving through the New York Turnpike or something. Mistrust of government. But we also found, which we didn't find in the polls, equity concerns. And what this was is that why am I paying the toll on my ramp and the next ramp down the road doesn't have to pay the toll? And you find this in projects around the world and in the United States, that if it doesn't look fair, the fairness concerns start rising up as people wonder why one person gets a better deal than someone else.
So explain that to me. Why wouldn't you toll every on-ramp on the freeway? Because, I mean, I'm looking at the map, and, you know, the major interchanges aren't tolled at all, except maybe Highway 99 is one of the major ones, but you're not tolling at TV Highway or you're not tolling at Shoals Ferry Road. I mean, so why not toll them all?
Well, the answer, Senator Starr, is that Washington County didn't propose that. They proposed doing just these ramps.
So where is
Washington
County?
Right. I mean, it may well be.
Who's responsible for Washington County, and why aren't they here to talk to us? Because they're not. Is your pitch hitting and you don't know? It seems to me, too, that I don't know why you'd cap the toll at $2. I mean, it seems to me that if you can guarantee, I've been on that road and it's taken me 30 minutes. It's, what is it? It's 7 miles, isn't it? The length of the
highway? I've been traveling a lot lately too, and it's.
I mean, I've been on that road when it takes me half an hour, and I would pay $5 if I could get through that road in 7 minutes.
Well, I agree with you. It may be that the proposal simply isn't expansive enough to understand what we could really accomplish on 217. I mean, that's probably true. But let me just say though, going much above $2, you've already priced off at $2 90% of the cars. So the amount of benefit you're going to get by going above that is going to be pretty marginal because you've already driven everybody off.
Well, I mean,
if you're going to charge $5, then you might as well just close the thing because no one's going to use it.
I doubt that's true. Mm-hmm. What are we? I guess my question is, what are we learning from this exercise that we've gone through? I mean, I guess we're learning that some of the diversion is not going to be that big of a deal. I mean, I guess what's the conclusion?
Well, I think the conclusion will be dictated by that committee when it comes back together and looks at the final results and sees whether or not they think they want to go forward with it. I mean, I can't answer that, is I guess what I'm saying. Yeah. I'm just the guy who tries to crunch the numbers and show it to the decision makers.
But, you know, one thing Senator Starr says that I think is important, and maybe re-looking at this, and I understand, you know, you're developing a model based on what your partner has asked you to do, Washington County, and so there's another question there. But the idea of 217 is, I remember on multiple occasions from your department, you know, has talked about and in terms of the design and the collector streets and how it's really, you know, it's morphed into totally unusable. In terms of as a throughput, highway. And it would be very interesting to see, well, like Senator Starr has said, you know, if you change the behavior, so in for all the ramps, say, we're told, whether it's $2 or whatever, with the idea of changing behavior to restore the highway to its original purpose and not as a local street, you know. And I'm guilty of the same thing. And, you know, I have someone I go office, I go off Hall Boulevard, and I hop on Denny and then take the next one off. And, you know, and I'm using it as a local street like everybody else is. And then, when you're trying to go from, you know, St. Vincent Barnes Road down to the highway, you're dealing with all of that. And it would seem like it would be very interesting to see what the model would look like and say, okay, let's make behavior on this whole 217 back to how it was originally thought it would be, which would be a throughput a highway as opposed to a residential street, which is how it's being used. And I just think that would be an interesting thing, maybe in your future discussions with Washington County, is to look at what that modeling would do and what it would do, you know, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years down the road, to accomplish that purpose. I just think that would be. And then some of these other questions, equity and all that stuff, obviously would be different because it would all be equitable. You were to say we're trying to get the highway back to be a highway again.
Well, Senator Metzger, I agree with you, and we're actually trying to put together a scope of work with Metro to go do this modeling to see what would happen if we did this in a more expansive way. The bind is, if we were going to do something bigger, we couldn't make the 3-year time limit that's in the bill because we'd have to go through NEPA, and we'd have to do a full EIS. So part of why we're limited is the fact that we're limited to what we can hope to accomplish within the 3-year time horizon that was set in the bill, and that did shrink the size of the project. Right. Let's be frank.
Well, I understand that, and one of the great opportunities now, especially with annual sessions, you have that opportunity, obviously, as you are doing today, to inform us of, you know, some of the limitations and have a discussion with the next legislative session about, you know, how you might be able to achieve things that that for unintended consequences you may be limited at. But obviously language and bills can change every day. So we all want to get the results. Say, can we, you know, have a good congestive pricing model that can be implemented and achieve results? And I'm sure you will find the next Transportation Committee, Senator Starr will be still on that, you know, very responsive to, you know, helping to make it work, because that's the ultimate outcome.
Well, let me show you this one last thing, because this should be of interest to you. And this has to do with where you start with those high negatives, is that those numbers can move around. When we asked people that opposed the tolling, how would they think if they knew that the revenue generated from the tolls was the only way to make improvements to 217? And right out of the gate, you can see that about 30% do change their attitudes if that is put in as the condition. And we put this here because, again, it's how you design these things will dictate whether they succeed or not. And they're actually more complex and a trickier business than probably a lot of us initially thought. But you can change people's attitudes by if you change the conditions of the experiment. What's next? Well, we're wrapping up this phase of the analysis. The policy committee is going to get together in February, and they're going to review the findings, and they're going to determine which, if any, of the projects they want to move forward. The city of Portland is still working on two variations of parking pricing, peak period parking, and they've told us that they think they can have a go, no-go by that February decision. So what we'll probably have on the table then are three of these proposals, and then we'll see where the committee wants to go with them. And then if whatever moves forward, we will then go into a public outreach effort. And it's important to understand this, that we did not go out to the public with these now because the local sponsors wanted to see this analysis to see whether they wanted to move forward or not before they had to publicly stand up behind the proposal. So we were giving them that opportunity, but the minute one of these is selected, we will then, and we have a plan already in place, to go out and engage the public with the proposals.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Senator.
So I noticed that you didn't talk about the Portland proposal. Is there a reason why you're not talking about that?
Should we schedule them at our next meeting? Yeah, they didn't think they wanted to go public with it. That's until they've got some more time to work on it. I should say, though, in their defense, is that we don't think that the implementation timing is as long. In other words, at some point, for one of these road ones, we have to make a decision far enough in advance to hire the firm, to put in the poles, you know, put the back room in place. The parking ones can be done a lot faster, so we're not under the same time constraint.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you for continuing, Mr. Williams. Okay, we'll close that informational hearing and open the report from Access Management Advisory Committee per Senate Bill 1024. And we have four individuals maybe contributing to this. Welcome back.
Thank you, Chair Metzger, member of the committee. Paul Mather, again, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT. Joining me up here is Bob Bryant. Bob is our regional manager in Central Oregon, but I've asked him on special assignment to work on the access management changes that we have underway in the department. It's we're taking it that seriously in the department that I wanted Bob and his experience with the topic to help lead ODOT as well as lead the ODOT's representation on the committee. So Bob will be walking you through the work of the committee and the work we've done so far. Before, though, I always want to give you a few opening remarks. As you know, ODOT manages access. We manage access for two primary reasons with ODOT, and that is primarily for safety and for congestion or function of the highway. And as we work through each of the different access issues, those are the values that we keep in front of us. But clearly, with the passage of Senate Bill 1024 and the current economic state of the state, things have changed in the world around us, and we need to adjust our rules and adjust our processes to also take those financial realities and economic realities that we have in front of us in place. And so as the committee's work, they've worked through those different values, safety, congestion, and economic opportunity. And there's been tough work as the committee has worked through those competing values and competing interests, but they have done good work, as Bob's going to outline. The other piece that the committee has worked on is our process, and it's come clear to us and through feedback from the committee and others that our process needs to be improved. It needs to be a more streamlined process, it needs to be a more open process, and it needs to be a more fair process that we have. And the committee has come to quick agreement around many of the changes in our process to improve that process. So with that as an introduction, I'm going to ask Bob just to walk through the work of the committee since the passage of the bill last February.
Okay, thank you. Welcome.
Chair Metzger, thank you. Members of the committee, again, Bob Bryant, the region manager for ODOT out of Central Oregon, for the record. And I'm going to start out my remarks by just emphasizing a couple of Paul's remarks, which is that our current rules that ODOT uses to manage access on the state highways were adopted in April of 2000. And clearly, ODOT's focus over the last decade in administering these rules has been on two things. One, ensuring the highest level of safety for the motorists, traveling public, and two, protecting the function of the highway for its intended purpose and for the public investment. So we acknowledge in doing so that the rules as they are place a burden on abutting property owners, business owners, in terms of mitigating impacts associated with managing the highway system. But we also recognize, as Paul has pointed out, the importance of working on the balance between how we manage the transportation infrastructure and our role in helping to promote and facilitate urban growth and community development and economic development opportunities in our communities. So with Senate Bill 1024, the legislation itself directed ODOT to bring together a group of stakeholders to help us look at how we currently administer access to the state highway. And come up with a more objective set of standards on how we accomplish that. We convened, ODOT convened a 25-member stakeholder committee in April of this year that has met monthly between the Access Management Committee itself and subcommittees of that group. over 20 meetings over the course of the summer and this fall. The committee consists of legislators, state senators, representatives, developers, home builders, consultants, traffic engineering consultants, AAA, the Association of Oregon Counties has been involved, and League of Oregon Cities, as well as, of course, ODOT. And some of the folks that have been involved are in the room today, of course. It's been a very significant contribution on everybody's part. Early on in the process, the committee agreed on focusing on five specific areas. The first one being reasonable access, clarifying how the term reasonable access is applied in the access management rules. The second one is the access management standards themselves and reviewing our existing standards, how they're used, and coming up with a set of standards that's more sensitive to needs of the system today and communities that are affected by our access management rules. The third being mitigation. We recognize certainly that the cost associated with doing the traffic studies to determine what impacts are created by development and more approaches to the highway, the time required to produce those studies, and then the cost of the mitigation itself on the business community and landowners is an impact. And so we spent quite a bit of time talking about that. The fourth item or area was medians, particularly non-traversable medians, and how that impacts access to property, of course, So we spent quite a bit of time focusing on how medians are used, both in terms of mitigation associated with an approach permit, a driveway application permit, as well as how we apply medians on projects for improving safety as part of a safety element as part of a project. And then the fifth area is change in use. Change in use is a specific provision that came out of Senate Bill 1024, the Access Management Review legislation that directed ODOT to look at the threshold that we currently have in there for businesses and properties that want to make an effective change on their property, either to expand their business or improve their business in some way. There's a threshold in our rules that say that if you exceed that threshold, you're required to reevaluate your access, your approach to the highway, and pretty much go through the process again to determine whether it's still appropriate given conditions that exist today. And the legislation essentially doubled that threshold so that it made less of a burden for those conditions where a property owner or business owner was looking to renovate or expand their business. So we put together, as part of the work from the stakeholder committee, the revised rules that were required to put that change in place. Part of the Access Management Committee took into account the highway function and classification and designations that currently exist in the Oregon Highway Plan. They distinguished between highways that serve urban areas, serve more as urban arterials within our communities, from those that have a higher level of importance from a statewide mobility perspective. This led to a lot of discussion on how to correlate the newly proposed the objective standards that we were proposing for managing access on state highways with highway classifications, making that correlation and using the highway classifications as defined in the Oregon Highway Plan, as well as making the distinction between urban areas versus rural areas in terms of how we make changes to those access management standards. Higher priority routes serving as statewide mobility routes are classified as statewide classification highways, and the lower level of importance routes, again from a mobility standpoint, are classified typically as our district and regional level highways. And then we've got further designations that indicate, such as expressways, that indicate our highest level of importance type highways from a mobility standpoint. And then on the other end of that scale, we've got special transportation areas and urban renewal or urban area arterials that allow for a lesser standard. And so we wanted to use those classification systems as we work through the process. The Access Management Committee will advance a legislative report early next year as requested and required by the Access Management Review legislation. The highlights out of that report will include, first of all, the revisions with regard to that threshold for change in use condition that I just referred to a minute ago. And those revisions will, again, make a less burdensome process for developers and landowners, business owners that wish to expand or renovate their existing business. Second, new access management standards, access management rules, mitigation measures, and spacing and mobility standards that are less stringent for district and regional, those district and regional classification highways that have less than 5,000 average annual daily trips, which is a specific provision also from Senate Bill 1024. And again, recognizing the level of importance for, from a mobility perspective for those higher speed urban routes and rural routes that serve as the statewide classification routes, the Access Management Committee is forwarding a recommendation to the legislature to exempt certain portions of those higher speed urban and rural statewide classification routes with volumes less than 5,000 average daily trips from the requirements of the legislation. And then we're also looking at the term reasonable access. ODOT's made a commitment to make major changes in how in our decision criteria for approving or for reviewing approach permits. And how we look at the term reasonable access within that criteria. And the goal there is to focus on how driveways can be permitted more so than rather than focusing on how we would deny an application. With regard to reasonable access, in terms of the objective standards that we put together, today the first step in determining criteria for approval on an approach permit involves looking at whether there's an existing access to the property. And if so, ODOT then makes a determination as to whether that existing access or alternative access, if it's not to the state highway, is or can be made reasonable. And again, that's an ODOT determination. And clearly, we acknowledge that our experience has been that, you know, in making that determination, that's from a highway perspective. That's the business we're in, more so than a business perspective or a landowner perspective. And so we want to eliminate or reduce the impact of ODOT having to make that determination on the front end. And so the changes that we've looked at, the revised criteria is going to be based on, again, a very objective set of standards, with the exception of those expressways, those highest level of importance routes, where ODOT, where the determination of whether there's existing access that's reasonable or can be made reasonable will be eliminated from the process. In urban areas and in rural areas, if you meet that standard, those objective standards that will be created through this process, we'll issue a permit. We'll grant a permit. Your permit will be approved. And likewise, if you in a rural area, if you have subsequent a request for subsequent driveways, then they also meet the standard. Likewise, those would be approved. In rural areas, there's a little higher test in rural areas whereby we would request additional justification for multiple driveways in those rural conditions. But still, the goal would be to work towards approving approaches without having a requirement that to generate all the traffic the traffic analysis that is currently required under the rule.
Right. Yes. I appreciate that, and we've looked at that. And I appreciate the level of detail. We probably don't need as much of that detail
okay.
in my committee at the moment. So,
okay.
I appreciate that. I'm glad this is always every session of the legislature. Access management is probably the most contentious issue of in any community at a given time. And I know personnel from the department throughout the state. If you add them up every year, how many hours are spent on discussions of a given access? So I appreciate how difficult this is, and the work that in bringing folks together to try to make a more usable set of standards that are applicable, that meet our goals, but also recognize the realities of and that are different, you know, and different changes. Any questions for the committee?
Just one.
Yes, Senator.
It sounds like, boiling it down, that there's been an attitude change at the department, one where you're more apt to find a way to say yes as opposed to say no. Is that fair to say?
Senator Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, yes. I think that's been clear message that we've gotten since the testimony and bill passage last February, clear to the work of the committee. The feedback that we've gotten through that process has had a change in the department and just our approach to access management. And as we work through finalizing these, I think you'll see that come in form in many different forms, from internal processes to administrative rules to legislation will reflect that change.
Thank you.
If I could just follow on, Chair Metzger and Senator Starr, to highlight Paul's point, Director Garrett has asked the department, in addition to those items that the committee has been working on to change the rule and change the way we approach access in general, he's also asked the department to look at other initiatives that we can take on right now, as soon as possible, rather than waiting for these rule changes to take place. And there are a number of areas where we're focusing on that as an internal initiative, as well as the work from the Access Management Committee itself. So, again, yes, very, very significant change in terms of how we're approaching this. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you. Now, did anybody else want to comment on the Management Committee briefly? Because we're behind. That's why I want to move forward. But I want to give you an opportunity. I know I had two. Patrick's gone, but I had two other people that were mentioned. So, just want to add anything. This would be the time to do it, and then we'll try to move on.
I promise to be brief. Senator Metzger, Senator Starr, Senator Schrader, thanks for giving us a couple minutes. I'm Melinda Merrill. I'm Director of Public Affairs at Fred Meyer Stores. I'm here today on behalf of Don Forrest, who's our Senior Site Acquisition Manager. He's been on the Access Management Committee, but was unable to be here today, but has kept me in the loop for the last 6-plus months, so I'm pretty familiar with the progress that's been made. And my role here today is just to let you know that it is working. It's a good process. It's worth it. It's been really a little bit of a breath of fresh air when you look at sometimes some other task forces and committees that get formed out of these kinds of situations. We, at Fred Meyer, over the last couple years, during what I hope have been the darkest days of our recession, have continued our capital expenditures. We put over $100 million into some of our Oregon stores. We have a $35 million store going up in Wilsonville. Right now it has walls. So, and this Access Management Committee had a lot to do with it. And we get the tough balance. We understand that. There's safety issues. There's congestion issues. If it's not easy to get to our store, if it's not safe, that's going to impact our business as much as if you take away one of our access points. So it's been a really important process. And I want to give a couple shout-outs to Director Garrett and to Bob Bryant, the Region 4 manager, and other ODOT senior managers who have they just set the tone for it. They rolled up their sleeves. They got to work. They brought everyone else on the committee with them, and it's been a good process, and we're looking forward to the end result. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Melinda. While you're here, mm-hmm. If you know, because I'm just throwing this at you, how is Fred Meyer feeling about where we are right now with the Sunrise Corridor Phase 1 on Highway 212.
Thank you for that.
One of the issues in trying to make sure that when things started getting modified, I know we were at a number of meetings there, Director Garrett was at them too, it's making sure that the business people that we were trying to, a great part of this was to ensure the jobs that we have in that corridor would stay there because of the frustration. And I was curious to how the company feels about where we are right now in developing Mighty Fine, I think would be the right
Mighty
word.
Mighty Fine, yes. Yeah. Thank you, Chair. It's been a really long process. There have been a lot of public affairs directors at Fred Meyer that have been through it. But we're just pleased. And we are so grateful to Director Garrett and to Jason Tell. We're grateful to Clackamas County and Senator Schrader. And I know Representative Hunt helped a lot, too. The people that came together at the end when we got together and were finally told what the final solution was, the people in that room, it was the businesses, it was the elected officials, and it was just great. And I know it took a lot of hard work and compromise and creative thinking, and we're very pleased, and you helped save our distribution center and our store, so
yeah.
We're grateful. Thank you.
Good. I'd love to get that off. Yeah, Senator Schrader.
Just make a comment. I do want to thank all of you. I remember talking to Jason about this, and Director Garrett appreciate it. The other group I'd like to mention that actually did a lot of work behind the scenes is the Clackamas County Business Alliance.
Ah, yes.
Actually, I know also came together, and I hoped, if I understood, I know we have Oregon Ironworks there, too, that needed some mitigation. And in order to have you remain and stay and get that worked out, and also give them an opportunity for business expansion in the middle of the recession was quite a feat. So thanks for working so hard to make sure that everybody got their needs met. And so.
Yeah, Senator Metzger, Senator Schrader, yes, and thank you. And I know Oregon Ironworks did a lot of creative thinking, too, so we appreciate that and won't forget it.
Okay. Sorry for the diversion, sir.
No problem. Senator Metzger, Chair Metzger, and Senators, pleased to be here. I'm Mark Whitlow, land use attorney with Perkins Coie, but I've been on these committees on behalf of a couple of trade associations, the Retail Task Force and the International Council of Shopping Centers, ICSC, and we were part of the SB...
International Council of Shopping Centers.
It's an amazing...
People come up with a way to create an association for anything, right?
Well, it's a national one. It's actually one of the largest ones in the country, 75,000 plus members, but it's been around since the 50s, but it is interactive with matters of importance to retail use and development, and so I sit as their chair for the state of Oregon, and I'm on the committee under their name, among others, but this is good work, and I just want to say ditto to the comments that Melinda has made, and to give thanks to Director Garrett and to the other upper management people, Bob Bryant included, for this fine work. And it is a change, a sea change in attitude as we see it. I mean, we've wrestled with these issues too many years and sort of pushed each other's buttons. But I think we are being listened to in a realistic way. To have the perspective of the adjoining owner looked at from the viewpoint of what is reasonable access under the statute is an amazing thing to hear. So we were pleased with the passage of the measure, the 1024, earlier this year. We're even more excited about the implementation. So, we're here from the other side of the table to tell you, yes, this is working. And so we're just pleased as we can be. So
great.
That's it.
Excellent. Thank you. Any questions? Thank you for taking
the
time to come down. Appreciate it very much. Okay. We'll close that informational hearing and open a report on the City of Hazardous Materials, Transportation, and House Bill 2001. And back for the hat trick is Paul Mather, for you hockey fans out there.
My office was at home, or else I'd throw it off.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT. We'll be picking up to the other half of the conversation you had earlier with Dave Williams about Cornelius Pass Road. Again, this is a topic Jason Tell was here to give today, but since Jason's under the weather, I'm pinch hitting for him, and I've asked David Kim to join me here today to help with some of the details and some of the questions that you may have. But one, just to quickly walk through Section 21 of the Jobs and Transportation Act, which required ODOT to work with local governments to select a county road dealing with hazardous materials, and the road that met that definition with Cornelius Pass. And we've worked with both Multnomah County and Washington County in a group of stakeholders in that area to form a group
to work on this issue. Maybe just backing up just slightly, a little history about, which I'm sure you're more aware of probably than I am, living in the area, but this this corridor, there was a tragic accident that occurred a couple of years ago that really brought the issues on that road to light. And we've been working on safety issues in that corridor since. We've asked, working with FHWA, brought them to the table with the two counties and did a safety audit in that corridor, and were able to use some of the stimulus money that came from the federal government to make some improvements in the area. And Senator Starr, I would, you know, characterize those along the lines of the guardrail, the type striping type improvements, the lower level improvements. But I'm pleased to report, just in the anecdotal information we have so far, we don't have accident reports yet, but anecdotally from the sheriff's office and those that use the corridor, they're noticing less accidents in the corridor with those improvements. So we're on the right track with improving safety in that corridor. But with the passage of the Jobs and Transportation Act, specifically Section 21, we began to work on further improvements in the corridor. And as I described, we formed this working group to the project team to begin working on that. Selected DKS Associates and Kittleson Associates to act as consultants to help us work through and sort through the issues in that corridor. In any corridor or any stretch of highway, we're able to access DMV records and really get a pretty good picture of the accidents. But in this case, we actually went a step further and went to databases within the sheriff's office, local law enforcement, and really pick apart exactly where the accidents are, and did some very detailed analysis on each of the curves, each of the intersections. And if you would like, you know, we can set up further briefings. But we have a lot of detailed information that's going on in that corridor. Where we are in the stage of preparing the final report, we're not to the final report yet. We're still a month away from that, but we have a lot of the data that's going to go into that final report. And what we're looking or asking the consultants to do in the final report is to look at, a range of options. We've done the kind of the low-hanging fruit with some of those sign improvements, guardrail, striping, rumble strip type improvements. Let's look at another kind of notch above that. And so there's going to be likely a solution in the $10 million range that does look at sight distance improvements, look at some limited curve corrections type improvements. That'll be kind of at the medium range of things. And then we're going to look at one that's probably closer to $25, $30 million that looks more aggressively at straightening out curves, major intersection improvements, and major improvements in the corridor. So again, that report is still probably a month away from being finalized, but that's just a preview of what would to come in that final report. With that, any questions? I'd be glad to take any questions. And again, I got David Kim here to help with any of the details.
Any questions? I think everybody will be looking forward to that in February. Thank you.
Good. Yeah. Thank you.
All right, we'll close that informational hearing and. Two more left. We'll open an informational hearing on the Road User Fee Task Force with Jim Witte, who sometimes is quite witty before the committee. We'll see how he is today. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Witte. I'm manager of ODOT's Office of Innovative Partnerships and Alternative Funding. But today I'm coming here as a staff or administrator to the Road User Fee Task Force, which was reconstituted by the governor, Senate President, and Speaker just this year to address an emerging hole in the state's principal road revenue mechanism, the gas tax. Owing to expected wide introduction of electric and plug-in hybrid electric vehicles, for which operators will pay little or no gas tax. By the way, today's the day that the Nissan Leaf I heard on the radio arrived in Oregon. So it was the first time this car we heard about showed up.
Oh, and I saw on CNBC this morning the first delivery of the new first Chevy Volt in California. So, yeah.
It's begun. Anyway, the rough tough determined that, Senator Schrader, we refer to the Road User Fee Task Force as rough tough, its acronym.
Okay.
So, The rough tough determined a mileage-based charge would best parallel the broadly based applied gas tax for those highly efficient vehicles. And it looked at the original pilot project that ODOT did years ago to determine is there any relevancy to this application, and determined that no, the pay at the pump model will work with vehicles that don't go to the pump at all, or at least only occasionally, and so something else needed to happen. And so ODOT, fortunately, has been looking at an alternative to address public concerns that have emerged over the years that we've become aware of, and electric vehicles. And it's based on what's called an open systems architecture that does not rely on collection at the point of sale. I presented to them the perceived efficiencies that others have found in our original work, policymakers nationally, technicians nationally, as well as everyday citizens. They were very valuable. And the basic objections were the reliance on the GPS receivers. That was number one. Even though ODOT worked very hard to design them in a way that would protect privacy, it was just not believable to the average citizen. And secondly, that the government-only data collection and payment system might result in a costly and inefficient bureaucracy. That was another concern. And then the policymakers nationally were concerned about a proprietary technology that we use in the pump model would likely become stuck in time and not be able to evolve with technology as it does today in so many other ways. So the task force approved a legislative bill draft, LC 1440, which you have before you, that provides a model for collection of something called a vehicle road usage charge from electric vehicle operators with great potential to resolve those deficiencies. This open system model has several positive attributes that align with existing data and collection systems that citizens already are familiar with, and therefore may make a mileage charge acceptable. The new collection system does not rely on vehicle location technology. That means it does not rely upon a GPS mandate. The system would instead collect a mileage reading directly from the odometers, existing odometer, through an electronic data transfer. So it's an odometer reading. The system would allow the motorist the option of choosing a mileage counting computer that uses GPS, just as millions do with smartphones today that has GPS in them. But they would opt in. They would not, and the government would not require them to. The ODOT would provide the basic data collection and payment system, but motorists would have the option of selecting private sector providers for of mileage data collection and payment services. And thus, motorists could select a trusted third party that they feel comfortable with. The system would also be based on an open technology platform with common standards that allows open onboard technology to evolve quickly as technology opportunities and market preferences change. And most importantly, it would allow collection from electric vehicle operators. The system would impose upon the owners and lessors of electric vehicles an obligation to report their mileage electronically in whatever manner they see fit, at a minimum the odometer reading, and pay a charge of 0.6 miles or cents per each mile driven. And the obligation would begin in 2014 model years. Now, I want to say something more about the 0.6 cents, because it was the issue of the rate was of considerable discussion at the task force level. The question was whether to set the mileage-based fee rate at what an average gasoline-paying vehicle would pay in gas tax, which on January 1 will be the equivalent of 1.43 cents per mile. That's the mileage fee rate for a 30-cent gas tax. Or whether to set it at the rate that the highest fuel-efficient gasoline vehicle would pay, which is essentially the Prius at 50 miles per gallon, and that's 0.6 cents per mile. The task force decided they didn't want to disincent the market ahead, while it was emerging, and so they reached consensus on setting the rate at 0.6. But they, with the idea that an eye be kept towards raising the rate to the higher level once the market has formed. And, of course, they did not set a target date for that, but that was the intent. And so there's no language in the bill for that rate to climb. It's just something that everybody's going to have to remember, I guess. So as far as the rest of it goes, LC 1440 contains all the elements of a tax or fee collection system that you would expect, including refunds, penalties for later nonpayment, collection of delinquent payments, appeals, similar provisions. The bill draft also creates a refund of fuel taxes for operators of plug-in hybrid vehicles who do pay some gas tax. So the LC 1440 was introduced, the House Committee agreed to sponsor it yesterday, so it'll be introduced at the request of Road Use Fee Task Force in the 2011 session. The other thing of note is that the Road User Fee Task Force recommends the legislature conduct a regular review of the revenue implications of the vehicle road usage charge in the context of the cost responsibility study, but this recommendation is not contained in the bill. So I'm hoping to have at some point an opportunity to speak in front of the Revenue Committee and make that recommendation, because I think that's something they should consider. That's basically it, Mr. Chair.
Okay, great. Questions? Senator Stark.
Yeah, so the 2014 model years, that's just because it's going to take us 3 years to get the whole thing figured out?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, yes. Actually, I'm a little concerned it might take a little bit longer, but it's worth a push to try to get it done as quickly as possible. You have to set up all of the computers and the management system for the system and get all the people on board with the technicians and what to make it work. So that'll take a little bit of time. And then, most importantly, work with the electric vehicle manufacturers to make sure that we can have an electronic odometer. We know technically it can be done. There's three different ways I know of that can happen. But we haven't worked with them yet, because there's no mandate. But if there was a mandate, we'd work with them, and they'd have to put those in for 2014 model years.
You know, Mr. Chair, this is a technology solution to a very real problem that we're facing as a state, as a country. We're going to let these guys skate for three years. I bet you that it doesn't take Intel 3 years to figure out a technology problem like this. It doesn't take IBM 3 years to figure out a technology problem like this. It doesn't take fill in the blank, virtually any of our private companies with technology solutions, 3 years to come up with the next generation of whatever they're doing. I'm hopeful that we can get it done sooner.
Yeah,
I'm
sure.
So are we, to your knowledge, one of the first states is looking at this kind of a model? Is there anybody else out there? You mentioned the nation and other. So is anybody else leading the way, or are we once again kind of, leading the revolution ourselves?
Mr. Chair, Senator Schrader, Oregon's been a leader on this for nearly a decade. Various approaches to do this. We did the original pilot project that captured the attention of the nation. The discussion, we're not alone, though.
Okay, that's right.
This discussion has captured the attention of the nation and Congress, and numerous states are planning pilot projects, and there's a lot of policy development in the states. But we are years ahead in our thinking and our understanding of public attitudes on this and how to respond to them. And I'm hoping this new approach will remove a lot of the public objections that have occurred up to this date, and we will be able to go forward.
Good. I just have a comment, and this doesn't actually affect your area, so it's more just for the public record on this issue. And it ties into what Senator Starr said. I mean, obviously there's a lot of benefits from moving to the electric vehicle, but as we are all aware, and why you've done such good work in the last number of years, figuring out a way so that it is equitable in terms of the cost of using the system. And just kind of for the record, I have a concern about, as people move forward, is also we have a tendency to get real excited about things and want to do things. And I know we have talked about the other aspect of that is, the charging stations, and we had that discussion last year, remember, about free ones on the freeway and all this. And I understand certainly the balance of trying to incent things, but just one word of caution to the to the general public and certainly not the department is that not only are we need to address the issue, as Senator Starr said, of people using this technology, which is great, but not paying for the upkeep, and how long does that string last, and how comprehensive do we get at it. But the concept, which I'm totally against, is saying then that also not only are not going to pay for the road, but the rest of us are going to pay them by essentially electric rates, giving them free electricity, which we then it makes other ratepayers have to pay for. So I know there's a balance of that. So this is just for the public at large, is that as these things grow, the ability to recoup the cost are going to be there for the users. And I just hope that we don't get so caught up that you think that's free to charge when you're really the other ratepayers are the ones who would be paying for that. So we need to find a balance to make sure that that the electrical usage we make it convenient, but it's not going to be it should not be a free filling station either, that people can come and get free gas, and we want to make sure that the market as it takes care of that, we don't produce, as we sometimes do in government unintentionally, but produce the concept of the freeway. How do we change that language? We heard, Paul, the freeway. Well, it's not free, but people think it is. And if we start setting policies that makes it from day one thinking that it's the state government or local governments are to provide free electricity, and then try to charge for that later, like it should be, like with anybody else in their household, it creates a problem. So that's not your area, Mr. Woody, but it does tie into what Senator Starr is. Users all need to pay the right form, and that's from plug-in to the asphalt as well. So I hope that in the enthusiasm for that, we don't start putting a bunch of free public plug-ins. I'm sure those people with companies can find a market to do that and make it profitable for themselves to do that. So, thank you for your report. Thank you for your work. Okay, we have one last, and then we're going to do some committee measures. We'll be done. So we're going to close that, and we'll open up an update on practical design with Paul Mather and Kathy Nelson, who has a box. Welcome again,
Senator Metzger, members of the committee.
You might start liking this thing. Next session, maybe Matt's trying to say, "Hey,
careful with that." Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT, here to give you an update, or actually the final report on practical design. Practical design, as you know, is a provision of the Jobs and Transportation Act and required ODOT to go back and implement the tenets of practical design within our department, go out and learn from other states who have successfully implemented, learn from current practices that are within the department, and put those into a program and implement those in a systematic way within the department. I've asked our chief engineer, Kathy Nelson, to kind of walk you through the program. She's been kind of the owner champion of this within the department. Kathy and I are very passionate about this and implementing and really watching the culture change within the organization and how we approach design. And so, Senator Metzger, as I know you're sensitive to time, if we get too much into detail again on this presentation, I'd ask you just to
presentation, and then we'll have questions.
Be more practical in our presentation.
Yeah,
even.
Just because it's written doesn't mean we have to read it all. Yes. Okay. Great.
Good. So.
Yeah, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, Chair Metzger and Senators. You have in your packet, we do have the report that was a requirement out of the Jobs and Transportation Act that we file that report by November. So you have our entire implementation plan and the different steps that we did and the final products. You also have the practical design strategy that we've put together that has more in-depth information on the different things that we're working on. And so do I need to do something here to set this up and go? Okay, that's great. Thank you. So basically, my presentation, I'm going to talk about the what and why we're doing practical design, exactly what the overarching philosophy is, the work products, the different project examples. And as we're moving forward in this, one of the big things, thank you very much, One of the first things that we did is that we did have a peer exchange that was sponsored by the Federal Highway Administration. We did that back in July of 2009, right after we had the legislation that was finalized, and we brought in different DOTs from, Minnesota, Missouri, Kentucky, and we had Pennsylvania on the phone, and we talked about the different things that they were doing. It was very informational. But one of the other big things that we learned was that there's a lot of things that we've been doing within the department, that a lot of the components that other state DOTs were doing in what they might have been calling smart transportation or practical design or different initiatives that they were doing. A lot of our work with multidisciplinary teams, our work with public involvement, some of the corridor context, some of the programmatics that we've done in our TIA program, a lot of those individual elements were present in our project delivery process. But what we haven't done is actually tied all of those different pieces into a comprehensive strategy that and a more disciplined and rigorous approach. So one of the first things that we did is that we settled on what our definition was going to be on practical design, that it's a strategy to deliver focused benefits for the state's transportation system while working within the realities of a fiscally constrained funding environment. Really important that we get our staff focused on thinking about system benefits, incremental improvements, being really clear on what the purpose and need of every individual project, every individual program, and being really thoughtful that we have a constrained funding environment. So this is really the basic foundation of our program, and the fact that we were able to come up with an acronym means that it's a real transportation program, and it's scope values. And these values are absolutely foundational to all the work that we're doing. And what we ask every single program, every single project team, is to be looking at these individual values in every single project that they're doing. First and foremost, safety. We will not compromise safety. We will make certain that every single project that we are doing will either improve the safety of that facility or it'll maintain status quo. But one of the big things that we're trying to get across to our folks is there are times that you can use lower design standards and actually improve the safety of a facility. An example might be if you have a downtown where you have a lot of multiple use, different modes. You have pedestrians, you have businesses, you have traffic that needs to get through, you have bicyclists. If you actually slow the speed down, you may actually improve the throughput in that corridor, and you actually make it much safer in that downtown area where you're actually trying to integrate the different modes. And so different things like that. You may actually narrow a lane. You may widen a sidewalk. You might do some different types of things that still allow all the different modes to operate. But again, we're maintaining safety in that individual system. Corridor context, really critical. Need to be thinking about how the corridor is operating today and how we expect it to operate in the future. What are the community's expectations? What are land use expectations? What's the environment looking like? It's causing us to look back at some of our expectations around some corridors. Maybe that's changed over time, and we need to go back and we need to look at that and be really thoughtful. How are we planning on building out in those different areas and make certain that individual projects actually maintain that corridor context? Optimize the system. This is a really big one. We want to make certain that every single project is contributing to the system, not just the individual project itself, that it's the best that it can possibly be, but that we might actually make certain that the system is being improved. So an example might be you might have a number of different safety issues that are happening in a corridor, and you might have determined that it really is about some left turning movements at a variety of different intersections. Previously, we might have approached a safety improvement. We'd go to intersection number one, and we'd look at all the different things that we needed to upgrade at that particular intersection. And we may have spent all of our money at just that single intersection when the real issue was that there were a number of different left-turning problems at a variety of intersections, and if we could have just put in a left-turn pocket at maybe two or three different intersections, we might have solved the issue in that particular corridor, made that corridor safer, and actually stretched our dollars further. So again, what we're trying to be really thoughtful is about the overall system, every single investment and every single project, making certain it's improving that system to the best it can. Public support. This is not a shortcut to say that we're going to go in and not look at all the different issues that the different communities and the different stakeholders have. We need to make certain that we understand every single stakeholder need on every single project and every single program. We need to seek it out. We need to involve them. They need to be a part of shaping the solutions. And we need to work to reconcile competing needs among those different stakeholders. And last but not least, because this is not in any sort of order, every single one of these values is absolutely essential, is efficient cost. At the end of the day, we understand that we do not have enough resources to meet all of our transportation needs. So we need to make certain that we are optimizing our decision-making, optimizing our investments. We need to make certain that every single investment that we do justifies the cost. And that applies to not only the big decisions that we're making, but we're also looking for times where we might be able to invest small amounts for great value. When might an incremental change make a difference? So again, these are not new concepts to the Department of Transportation. We've been looking at safety corridors, optimizing system, public support, efficient cost. All of those are things that we've been working with on a really regular basis for a very long time. But what is new is actually pulling them all together into defined, repeatable, accountable strategy. So we have a number of different tools, talked about that a little bit earlier, processes that we've been utilizing, but there was a missing link. We knew that we weren't necessarily systematically integrating all concepts in a balanced approach all of the time. Not all of our teams really knew when they'd reached the right solution. How do we document and hold ourselves accountable to delivering the right solution? When is a project good enough? How do we know that we're making a difference in the transportation system? So we developed some tools. We actually sat down with a whole lot of folks in our project delivery staff. We had a workshop way back in October of 2009, and we asked them what kind of tools would help them in actually integrating those different values and making certain that we're being rigorous in our approach. We came up with, number one, a project charter, that if we actually had a document for every single project that was an agreement between the project sponsor and the folks that are delivering the project that clarified exactly what is the problem that we're trying to solve, how are we going to go about doing it, what is the dollars that are available to do that, and that they actually were in agreement on every single project, and they documented that in a project charter, that would help. The other piece, a tool that we thought would be useful, is a decision matrix. Specific points within our project delivery process where we actually checked in on those different scope values, and that we actually defined and wrote down and documented how are we delivering each of those scope values through the project, and we checked in throughout the life cycle of that project. That too would help us stay accountable. And then just developing a strategy where we talk about those values and we talk about our roles and responsibilities associated with them. That's valuable. So very quickly, project charter, just a little bit bigger. You have it, I believe, starting on page 32 within your strategy, and also in Appendix B gives you different kinds of examples. But it's really simple, and it is an opportunity for us to ensure that we have mutual alignment, support, commitment for project sponsors, the folks that are program managers or region managers or area managers that are actually, they've initiated the project, they've worked with their acts to define this is a project that we need to do. They've identified the budget that might be available for that, and the project team that's actually delivering the project. What's really important about this document is that we actually have a robust conversation, that we get all the issues out on the table, that we make certain that we reach consensus, and at the end of the day we sign up for that and we hold ourselves accountable to delivering that throughout the process. That's the piece that's really important. We have now implemented project charters for all new projects. We did that starting back in April. We also asked project teams, if you were at a place in the development of a project where this would add value, by all means, use it. So we are using it in all projects today. This is a very simplified version of our project delivery process. The top box talks about our planning program development level. The yellow in the middle is really our design phase, where we're actually developing contract plans. When you move down into the blue, we're actually handing that off to be constructed. And what I've identified, and we have a lot more detail in the strategy document if you want to get into that, but I've identified five specific check-in points that we now require project teams to have specific tasks associated with defining their project charter, making certain they've documented the purpose and need of their particular project. We do that at step one, and that's actually a place where we're trying to integrate information coming out of our planning departments, our folks that own programs, that they're actually giving information to project teams. What is our expectation around managing our bridges, managing our pavements, managing our safety projects? What is that expectation? What's the funding that's available to manage the entire system? How do you translate that over to a project team so that they can start developing a specific project? We have that check-in point at number one. That's a brand new check-in point that we've never had before. At number two, between actually moving out of scoping and moving into just the beginning of a project initiation, that's where we actually finalize our project charter. And we need to make certain that we're all on the same page, that we sign off on that. We have that documentation included in our project file. and that we also document scope integration. We have just a number of simple questions, but we're trying to instill a culture within our folks that are developing and designing and delivering projects. You need to know, how are you delivering safety on this particular project? What is the corridor context? Has it changed? Do we need to make adjustments? How are we optimizing the system? How's your individual project making a difference? Do we have all the stakeholders on board? And is this the best, most efficient, cost-efficient solution we can possibly come up with? We want to make certain that we have documented that in our project. We check back in at checkpoint 3, which is the point where we've actually, we call it DAP, it's our design approval point, where we've actually defined the footprint of a project, and we're now ready to move into final design, go acquire right away, go get our permits. We want to make certain that we're all in the same same place. Number 4 is after we've actually gone all the way through final design and we're we're developing contract plans, we want to check back in again and make certain we're still on the same page. And at number 5, after we've actually built the project and handing it over to maintenance, we want to check back again. We expect 4 and 5 to be places where we're going to actually have continuous improvement, where we're going to learn how did that process work, were we able to stick to things, were there things that we didn't have some information that we needed in planning, so we should have done that earlier. Basically, we're expecting that we're going to be adding rigor to our process that we haven't had before. Some of our projects, this may be very simple things, others may be very complex. So I have a...
Senator Metzger, that's basically our presentation.
Yes.
If you want us to go through the 2 examples we have here, we can take time and go through
let's see an example.
Okay.
See an example.
Okay, good.
Okay. And bear in mind that these examples are, as we've developed training, and we've trained about 450 folks in our organization on these basic principles, and we spent a lot of time saying exactly what it means. But these projects were developed prior to having practical design in place. So again, it just sort of reinforces that we have a lot of the concepts, but most of our folks, all of the folks, that when we've actually brought these examples out and we think about how practical design, if we were to do them today, they all believe that they would have come up with similar good ideas, but they would have gotten there sooner. Because we all would have been rowing in the same direction. We all would have been looking for these different things. Oftentimes, when you're trying to do something a little bit different, a little bit out of the box, you have a lot of people you have to convince. This is really a cultural shift for us that we're all looking for this. So the first project we have is Maupin, which is on Highway 197. And those of you that are familiar with this particular area, it's right on the Deschutes River, and that is an area that they're really looking at increasing tourism because you have a lot of folks that are river rafting there, and so they wanted to make an improvement in their downtown, and they were able to secure some money in order to improve sidewalks. The sidewalks were deteriorating significantly, and the pavement condition was also poor, but this was really about a sidewalk improvement. But what they found is as they got into trying to make improvements in the sidewalk, that because there's a very steep vertical grade through their downtown and the cross slope that was going across the road, and the fact that we really wanted to minimize the dollars that were being spent here and make them go as far as they possibly could. We didn't want to acquire right-of-way, so we wanted to make certain that the sidewalk would match the road and match the business entrance, and they found that it was absolutely impossible to technically replace those sidewalks without fixing the road at the same time, because the height of the sidewalk would have gone all the way from zero to enough to catch your car doors on it, and so it wouldn't have solved the problems that they needed. But the sidewalk was in very poor condition, but again, it wasn't number one in areas that we were working on. But what they were able to do, and the reason that this is a really, we believe it's a practical design approach, is that they stayed focused on their purpose and need throughout that project. It was about making certain that they improved those 4 blocks of downtown for economic development and make certain that it was as safe and functional as it possibly can. But they stuck to those 4 blocks. And they were able to leverage a number of funding sources that, again, were priority needs out of those different funding sources. We got it out of our bike ped fund. We were able to get some additional dollars out of our pavement folks, but only for those 4 blocks. Normally, we would have paved the entire grade, but we only focused in those 4 blocks. We made some choices around pavement depth in different on both the shoulders and the main travel lanes in an effort to try and stretch those dollars as far as we possibly can. They limited right-of-way acquisition. They were not going to add additional dollars. They leveraged funding from the city that they were able to get some additional things because we were tearing up the road. They were able to get some water and sewer and a variety of different things, and this is what it looks like. It looks good. They really made a difference. This is actually where we got the idea for a project charter from, was out of this particular project, because these folks actually developed one, again, outside the practical design arena. They actually had the mayor of Maupin sign off on this particular project because it was such a collaborative effort with the businesses and the communities and the different folks that were participating in this area. Mm-hmm. And so just really quickly, here's some before and after pictures, again, highlighting our different values that we're utilizing from the safety point standpoint. You can see, even though this was not one of the projects that we had identified for pavement preservation, it should have been right up in that list. It's just that we have others that are in front of it. Clearly needed to make improvements. But we were able to develop some bulb outs, did some traffic calming, improved the overall system for pedestrians and bicyclists while keeping freight moving through that corridor. Again, here's the corridor context. We stayed, we made certain that the downtown fit the downtown look, but we transitioned off of a highway on both ends, and so you're able to keep the throughput, the freight moving very efficiently, but at the same time resurrect the character of that downtown so it functioned safely the way it ought to. Optimizing the system. Again, since we were tearing up the road, it made it so it was cost-effective for the city actually to go in and do improvements in their water and sanitary sewers. And again, they paid for that and brought those dollars to the table. It really was a collaborative approach. And again, we had numerous stakeholders. Along this stretch, while we have a downtown area, you also have a school, you also have homes. There's a whole lot of folks that were along this corridor. They all participated. They all were pleased with the outcome of this particular project. It worked really, really well. And at the end of the day, they met the purpose and need of this project. They utilized and stayed within the available funds that they had and leveraged a whole lot of funds in order to make this work. So we really think that this was an example of practical design.
Senator Metzger.
Yes, Senator Schroeder.
Good question. I am intrigued with this because obviously I have a number of cities in my district that, particularly Oregon City, quite frankly, and I've talked with Director Garrett about this, is really trying to do this downtown corridor development. And how were these, I mean, this is a small city.
Mm-hmm.
Where did they have the capacity, in your opinion, to try and find an access to these other funds and other, you know, opportunities? Who was it, a volunteer group? I mean, they brought all of this to the table, and so was that a key factor in ODOT kind of working with them?
Chair Metzger, Senator Schroeder, most of the funding sources for this were transportation funding sources, but they were in our different categories. So they were in bike ped, they were in sidewalk. Transportation enhancement, they had to compete through processes to gain those. They also did, as Kathy mentioned, brought funds to the table from their water sewer relocation project that they were going to be doing anyway. So it was really, I wouldn't describe it as, you know, additional money that they brought to the table. They were really took ownership of the project, applied for these various grants, applications, really had the vision for their downtown and kind of brought us along for the ride in creating this and utilizing our various funding sources. What Practical Design and this charter process did for us was stay true to that vision that the community have to implement that.
Well, I think this is quite remarkable, and despite the fact this is probably technically, well, it is my last time here on the committee, I certainly would like to do a follow-up, particularly with some of the local communities that I have continued to work with, to get the contacts and perhaps talk to both of you again about how did they manage to do it. Because so many of these smaller communities, as I said, don't even know where to start. And, again, being so small, I wonder, they must have had somebody really good, a good city manager who knew how to garner these dollars. So thank you.
Questions? Senator Bridger.
Did the business community, did these sidewalks go in front of businesses?
Yes.
Downtown?
Yes.
So did the businesses contribute to that portion of the sidewalk that was in front of their business, which is actually in local government, you know, that's the way it is.
Yeah.
You're responsible for the sidewalk.
Yeah. Chair Metzger, Senator Berger, in this case, no. This came out of the bike ped fund or sidewalk fund that we have for state highways. So the state highway in this case was different than a city street.
Okay. And I have one other question, Mr. Mm-hmm. Chair, please. In your talking about the different bullet points that you hit, you talked a lot about the project teams.
Yes.
But you didn't. I wasn't really clear about who the project team was, and how does that play into bidding into projects? In other words, do you change your has this changed the criteria, the standards that you set for people that are coming into the construction, or is this all in-house?
Chair Metzger, Senator Berger, our project teams are made up of largely ODOT staff from various disciplines, but more and more, and particularly in this case, we incorporated city staff, local people on that project team involved in our decision-making. How that affected or may affect decisions in the contracting is we may put stipulations in the contract as far as staging for businesses, as we get input from businesses, how to limit the impact our staging may have in construction on their businesses. We may put different requirements in our specifications as far as bidding processes or time of day or sequencing. There's various different things we can put in there that may come out of our project team that involves different community members.
I appreciate the work you've done on this, and just to make a comment on it, make it clear, because this was an element that I had put into this bill after meeting with folks at the Missouri Department of Transportation and then following up and some of this. And I realize that, without you having to say it, this isn't always easy. Actually, I have a cousin who's an engineer, but they're in the witness protection program today, and I won't say who that is. But his point has been is that, especially with engineers, he says do a lot of things, is that they forget to be engineers.
Yeah.
You know, and they'll pull out their 18 volumes of books, and they'll point, well, we're going to do it this way, whatever, and it drives you crazy, and they don't think anymore. I mean, they're an engineer, they're qualified to say, well, gee, how can we do this? You know, and the idea about practical design, I love the words you use, purpose and need, because that's what it gets to. You know, the word I use from some of the Missouri information was, you know, the minimum standard to accomplish the goal. You know, you're not sacrificing safety. You're not sacrificing, you know, the objective. They're saying, there's 20 cars that go in 24 hours on this road. We don't need to spend this. Oh, but there's always somebody in the room that says, well, according to chapter so-and-so, blah, 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 we got to do it. We spend all this money. And it's more than what it's meant to meet the need. And I would hope that going forward, and I know you'll get support in the legislative branch and everyone else on this, because we do want to maximize the dollars, and we want to, and we really want, I think, in all of state government, and particularly in the field of our interest, transportation, you know, is to allow, you know, our engineering staff to be engineers again, right, and, you know, solve the problem. Don't, you know, just because we always have followed, chapter and verse on this, it's like access management, right? You realize that, you know, it doesn't always work. And empower them to do that and purpose and need. And I have absolute confidence that, with that type of push and, you know, the flexibilities from all levels of management to allow people to think on their own how to solve problems, not only are they going to deliver a good product, but at a cost-efficient manner and
absolutely
allow us to do more good works. And,
absolutely.
And one of the things that I have said often, members of the committee has as well, is that, I'm very pleased about what this committee has done over the years and in the legislature in adopting, is because we have a partner with the department who has delivered what we said.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only reason we keep passing these things. Not that we don't have issues. We all have issues. You know, it's a very huge, and, you know, some can get contentious. But overall, delivering what we say, showing that we can think differently when times change, is what allows the confidence of the legislative body to give the department the resources and tools to do things. So thank you very much for that. And I will be following this with great interest.
Yeah.
Any other questions on this? Okay, thank you.
Thank you
very much.
I'm going to take one chair prerogative, and we're going to introduce bills, and we're going to be done. So you have a question, Senator Starr?
Not on this.
Okay. I'm going to ask Director Garrett to come up. I haven't told him about this, so I do, just because it's our last committee, I want to ask you about ON,
yes.
Director Garrett. I don't want to talk about the whole issue of that. That's not the point for this committee or my interest, but I read the editorial today. But I just... I just kind of want to make a point, if you allow me to do that. I was down in Berkeley with my sister watching the getting prepared to watch the Oregon-California game when Brent Wolf of the Oregonian called me. And I went down there, beautiful sunny weather, Brett's, and we spent about an hour on the phone. He was writing this series about Owen and everything else. And the reason he called me was because I was the one who was the sponsor of that bill and carried it on the floor. And so I was hoping people would forget that. But anyway, it led to a very interesting and long discussion about it. And one thing I pointed out to him is, and this is just something I just want to throw out to you, and that is that I said, I'm really pleased, though, despite everything else that we had talked about, is that the Department of Transportation was given this project now. I'm sure you're probably not really happy to have it in your pocket, but the point was, is kind of I was making with Mr. Mather and Kathy, is that I think of all the different organizations that, as difficult this is, if there's somebody's going to clean it up, I have more faith in the department than anyone else. So I just wanted to tell you that, and it's kind of like taking over an 0-16 NFL team. I said, really, it's kind of nothing to lose. I mean, you know, when you see the bad things you've done, you know, you started by, you know, doing the right thing with an audit to find out what's going wrong and where all the problems are. And I'm sure as you move forward with the legislature that you just outline, see it, call them as you see them, worry, you know, and acknowledging, you know, where there's mistakes is an okay thing. And I just appreciate the responsibility that the department's been given. I have confidence, though, that it was given finally. It should have been there in the first place, frankly, to do that. And as one person said who's been, like me, you know, following this with a lot of grief and trying to acknowledge where we are with it and why it's such a problem, and it's one of those issues where, and they said it was like, well, it's where no one has been in charge, and yet everybody is in charge. And I know what that's like, because you have local governments and first responders and everybody. They all have to be a part of it, and so they all help. It's almost like putting together an omnibus bill. You're putting all kinds of different things in, but, you know, it really doesn't, at the end of the day, maybe make sense, and costs go, and no one's really responsible for it. So it's very complex, and I'm certainly no happier than any other legislator about, you know, how it's moved, but and it's kind of ironic. It's a bill that was designed to be, you know, to help improve disaster response and first responders, and it has become the disaster. But you, I believe, and your colleagues are the first responders on this. So best of luck with that. I know it's difficult, and as Senator Starr was talking about Sunset Highway, you know, confidence in government, sometimes we just don't realize the damage that we unintentionally do to everything else that we do when we have these types of things happen. And so, anyway, just best of luck to that, and I think it's in the right hands, and I know you didn't volunteer for it, but I think your people are the ones to handle it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I truly appreciate the kind words, and had over the last couple of days, Senator Verger and I have had a lot of conversation about this. The bottom line is we have good folks who have stepped up and will continue to deliver in a transparent way, in a very straightforward way. And you said it. We say we're going to do something, and then we do it. Because I would submit to you and your colleagues here that we have not only been charged with delivering this project, but we are also charged with rebuilding trust and confidence. And that's a very, very fragile commodity, and we've lost that. I think we have the capacity of the Department of Transportation to go to school on the history here, but more importantly, stay focused and deliver something that will position the state of Oregon to protect its citizenry and to protect its men and women who are the first responders. So I appreciate your kind words, and if I can beg your indulgence, I want to thank you for being a partner. You have been nothing short of an outstanding chair, and I know this is maybe the last time I'll be in front of you, but your words that this committee and my agency are partners, music to my ears, because that's what we all work for. We are allies in moving the transportation debate forward, And I would submit to you that the leadership on this committee and your colleagues on the House side have truly been the economic tool over the last couple years in terms of turning out work that put paychecks in people's hands. And just think, as you said the last time we met, just think how worse the economy would have been for our friends in the trades if you hadn't made the investments going back till 2001, right up into 2009. We'll see what 2011 brings. We stand on the balls of our feet, knowing that transportation is an investment that yields dividends. But, sir, thank you for all you have done.
Well, thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Rick. Okay. We have one piece of business to do, and that is the introduction of committee measures. As you know, colleagues, as I turn over to Senator Starr, this is no indication of support or opposition, but traditionally we introduce as committee measures anything that's given to us, some of which, because I have a bill on elections, for example, they won't even end up in this committee, but we will get them in the process, and so I will turn it over to Senator Starr.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
I move the following LC drafts be introduced as committee bills. LC 363 dated November 4th, LC 430 dated June 8th, LC 1201 dated October 6th, LC 1285 dated December 13th, LC 1593 dated December 15th, LC 2440 dated October 11th, LC 2600 dated December 1st, LC 2722 dated November 5th, LC 2840 dated December 7th, and LC 2873 dated October 14th.
Okay. Senator Starr has moved the LCs, as he has mentioned them, to be introduced. If someone wants information on the particular one, they have been released publicly, so people can, now they know the numbers, can, you know, read anything they want, and they will be introduced in time for session for discussion. Is there any objection to the introduction of the measures? Not so ordered. Well, this is our last committee meeting, and I want to thank all of you, Senator Schrader, Senator Berger. I'm glad you're going to be chairing the money side of transportation.
Yeah.
And I'm very, very pleased that Senator Starr is once again going to be the senior member of the Transportation Committee next session. It's been a pleasure to work with all of you.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to compliment you again as chair of the committee. It's been amazing working with you over the last 8 years. It's been a lot of fun, and we've done a lot of good work. And this committee as well. I mean, we've had a fantastic committee. I'm just sad Senator George isn't here, because we've really worked well together as a team, and you as our leader. So actually, both you and Senator Schrader are going to be missed. There's no question about that. So,
well, thank you very much. And as I mentioned once before, I can't remember where, but I want to thank Senator Courtney because he did extend to me the last two sessions something that I'm probably going to get him in trouble because everybody else can, that he hasn't generally done, and that is he allowed me to pick you guys for the committee. Because I knew not only your commitment to business and transportation, but willingness to work hard and actually come up with solutions. So, anyway, it's been a pleasure. We're adjourned. Thank you.